Okay, well, it looks like it's working, so we'll just trust it.
Okay.
I'm going to set that there, and the microphones are pretty good on it, so it should be able to pick up our conversation.
Cool.
So like I said over the many emails that we exchanged, this is a biographical interview, so it's going to be, you know, starting with, childhood, teenage years, and hopefully, you know, time permitting, coming up to the present.
Sure.
So, not to sound like a bad therapist, but... why don't we start with your early years? I know you grew up in Chicago, but I don't know much about your family background, so
okay,
we can start there.
So my family, I didn't send you my Cavalier autobiography?
No, you sent me your speech and a short CV.
Okay, my speech where?
The Cavalier speech.
Okay, so that was the science?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I had to put together an autobiography for them, too.
I'd love to get a copy, because that way we can put it in with a file.
Send me an email, and I'll just
Will do.
Send it to you as an attachment.
Okay.
So, I grew up, I was born on the north side of Chicago. About the age of five, we moved to a northern suburb called Highland Park. And then... At some point, I went to the University of Chicago when I was slightly young, and then at the end of my time in Chicago, I left Chicago not to return. Basically,
what did your parents do?
Okay, so my father was a furrier. He didn't make them. He sold them.
Okay.
And by coincidence, his father had also been, but he was here. And in fact, he was a witness to the Triangle Shirtwaist fire.
Oh, wow.
Because this was the garment district
right.
in 1911, I guess, 100 years ago, when the fire took place. I never met my father's family. He had some rift with them. And his father was dead by the time that I was born.
Okay.
So he sold for my mother was a teacher. She was from Pittsburgh. During the Depression, my father was a traveling salesman, selling chenille bedspreads wholesale.
Okay.
His territory was sort of upstate New York. I don't think he ever got to New England, but also Pennsylvania, Ohio, I think as far as Detroit. And then he met my mother in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And they married there in the late 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 1942, territory was transferred to Chicago, and 6 months later, the boss's daughter got married, and the new son-in-law needed a territory.
Okay.
So he was out of work, and he hired on someplace as Christmas help, and he was very good at what he did, so he stayed on there and became the manager of this first store. This was sort of like, at the end of the war, and during the war, there was nothing you could buy,
right.
No industrial goods of any sort, but there was a lot of money around because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So people bought fur. So he did quite well for some other guy.
Yeah.
By 1953, when he struck out on his own, then there were cars, there were washing machines, televisions, whatever.
Yeah.
So the fur business, kept us going, but wasn't the kind of mega buck a year business by any stretch of the imagination that the business he built up for this other guy had been, because the demand was elsewhere.
What did your mom teach?
She was an elementary school teacher.
Okay.
She stopped teaching when we got to Chicago, or when they got to Chicago. I was born in 45, 3.5 years later. She didn't teach while she was there. My grandmother lived with them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was young, she didn't teach. And when I was old enough for her to go back to teaching, her mother got cancer, and she had to spend the next 5.5 years taking care of her.
Okay.
And then at the very end of that period, that was when I graduated high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was out of the house. I was no longer a problem. A little less than six months after I got to college, my grandmother died. Yeah. Then my mother went back to teaching, now within the city of Chicago.
Okay.
And she taught until 73,
okay.
When she was forcibly retired because of her age.
Okay.
She continued teaching in this sort of, you know, one-on-one school part-time.
Yeah.
Until she was about 79.
Did you have siblings?
No.
No, only child?
Only child.
Okay, me too. What did you like in school? What subjects were you good at?
Well, I guess I mostly liked science and math.
Okay.
I was a Sputnik kid, which was, I don't know if you know what that means exactly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you were born in 45, Sputnik was, you were 12 when it launched.
I was 12, so the following fall, a bunch of the better students were taken up to the high school for some exams, and the better of that group, according to those exams, were then taken every morning up to the high school for an algebra class.
Okay.
And then when I got to high school, and then we went back to the 8th grade in a middle school. And then the following year, we were put in advanced science and something like an advanced English class, and I think those were the only three. And so it was advanced math, advanced science, advanced English, and then, you know, whatever else we wanted to take for the fourth class.
Okay.
And so I stayed sort of a year ahead of myself then. And my father's business was actually on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we were in a northern suburb.
Yeah.
So he was, I mean, at my current age, I mean, I find it amazing how that he was so tired from the commute that he did. He did an hour and a quarter each way each day.
Yeah.
And so in his middle 50s, he started saying, well, gee, you know, he was 40 years older than I. He said, what, you know, you're getting all these extra credits and whatnot. Why don't you just graduate high school a year earlier?
Huh.
So I did.
Okay.
Probably a mistake, but anyway, I did that.
So you would have graduated in like 61, 62?
62.
Okay.
Yeah, and I went to the University of Chicago, and then I went there as a, you know, as a pre-med, because I didn't know anything else existed.
Okay.
Right? I didn't have a very close relationship, shall we say, warm relationship with the University of Chicago.
Okay.
They treated me like garbage, and I mean, I wasn't a star or anything at the time. And the main thing that I got from the University of Chicago was that this job exists. Hmm. I didn't know that.
This job meaning a chemistry professor?
Being a university professor.
Okay.
And that it's different from being a high school teacher.
Okay.
When I went to college, I honestly believe that a college teacher just taught more advanced, was just like a high school teacher, but teaching more advanced material to somewhat older students.
Okay.
I had no idea that there was, you know, that one could basically play all day doing research and get paid for it.
Uh-huh.
When I found that out, I immediately abandoned the notion of being a pre-med because there was something better that attracted me. And that was, that was how I sort of spent the rest of my life.
Okay. Did the space race interest you at all? Did you, you know, there's like a lot of money being put into that at the time.
Yeah, no, I mean, there was money being put into science at that time.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about the early 60s. This was what was referred to by the late 60s as the golden age.
Yeah.
You know, by the time I got to graduate school, the golden age was already over.
Huh.
I remember when I was in graduate school my first year, somebody came up to visit one of the postdocs in the lab, and he said, it was during the biophysical society meeting that happened to be taking place in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So he came up to visit one of the postdocs, and I just was listening to their conversation, and he said, you know, I just applied for a job at the University of New Mexico, and I, you know, which when I'd been applying to schools in high school was like, you know, where's that? And he said, and they said, well, we're really happy to, you know, examine your application. This is what they wrote back to him, but we have to tell you that there are 200 other applicants for this position.
Yeah.
So I knew by then, you know, it was over. From then on, it was going to be dog eat dog. It wasn't going to be a walkover. Anyway, so the golden age was over. But no, I wasn't particularly interested in that. I was my key scientific influence when I was in high school was my high school biology teacher. And he was the first one, you know, I had a bio teacher, a chemistry teacher, a physics teacher, whom I liked in the order, you know, 1, 3, 2. Chemistry was the least interesting. The physicist was second and most interesting, and the biologist was just fantastic. He was a little older than the others. He's obviously one of these guys who was screwed by the Depression, right? So he was, when I took bio from him in 59, 60, he was 50, early 50s, something like that. I mean, when you're that age, you can't actually tell, right? Yeah. You know, when you're 13, 14. You know, had the Depression not come along, he'd have probably gone on to do something more technically demanding than being a high school teacher. But he just did a great job of it. And he divided the school. The school year was administratively broken up into 2 semesters, each of which was 3 6-week periods long.
Okay.
And he divided the school year up, you know, as he saw fit. And it was a series of what he called units, where you had to put together something that was maybe 80 or 100 or maybe more, depending on the unit, pages long, where you answered a bunch of questions in as great detail as you could, and, you know, some of those answers entailed pictures of things you'd seen in the microscope, in the bio class, and some of, and whatever. But the first unit was about 5 weeks long, and it was all chemistry and physics, because none of us knew anything about chemistry and physics. You know, we'd come out of grade school. And the point that he was trying to make to us, which came through, you know, loud and clear, was that biology is a physical-chemical phenomenon. And, you know, that's where my head has been ever since, all right? Sort of right on that cusp. In more recent years, probably, I mean, at various times I've tilted a little bit toward the biological side, and various times I've tilted a little bit toward the physical side. Right now I'm probably closer to the physical than the biological side. But my first position was, in fact, in a biology department.
So in the early 60s, there was all this exciting stuff happening in molecular biology, you know, following...
Of which I was totally ignorant.
Okay.
I mean, in one... I mean, this high school teacher, this guy, his name was John Broming. Broming, B-R-O-M-I-N-G. And all these details are in the biography. Every day he'd put up some picture we were supposed to copy down and then put into these units that we were making. And one of the last ones in the year was a picture of a cell, and the word DNA was on it, and somehow the word RNA was on it. I don't think he understood in 1960. I don't think it was well understood in 1960 exactly how DNA related to RNA related to proteins. There was may have been, you know, known at the more advanced institutions.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Nirenberg and those people were still working out the...
The genetic code, when I took biochemistry the first time in the fall of 64, the genetic code was, it was sort of known that it was 3, but it was just kind of sort of known. They didn't present that in the class as a hard and fast fact. It was like, you know, we think it's 3, there's some data suggesting that, but we don't really know yet. About 2 years later, I heard a lecture from Govind Khurana, and by then it was clearly 3. He talked about his experiments and so forth.
So you picked biochem as your major
as my undergraduate major because it was, again, on what I thought was on this cusp. And at Chicago, that was a terrible decision. Biochemistry at Chicago had nothing to do with what seemed to be the neat part of biology, namely the stuff that seemed to involve some kind of arguably teleological logic, that seemed to have, you know, seemed to be interesting in terms of neat structures, anything like that. As far as they were concerned, this was biochemistry as developed by organic chemists, and their concern was the metabolic transformations of small molecules. How does glycine get made? What happens to it when it gets made? That kind of stuff. It was my third year before I actually took a course in my so-called major, and I really wanted to barf. I mean, it was revolting.
Okay.
Okay. And I might add, I didn't do very well. I mean, when I told my father in particular that I was going to be a biochemist and not a proctologist, he treated that like this was a decision to become a mobster instead of a distinguished person.
Okay.
So there were, inner conflicts within me during that whole period. And also, after a sense, I didn't really let college interfere with my education. So I was a shitty student.
Okay.
Okay. There's no, secret about that.
Okay.
And I didn't get along well with Chicago. Chicago didn't get along well with me. None of it worked out very well. I switched from what I thought was to something that I thought might be more interesting, which was physical chemistry. It turned out not to be terribly interesting. I went back and forth between the two of them, maybe three of them, a couple of times. Comes the springish period of 1966, and I'm supposedly graduating in the spring, and I apply to graduate schools in chemistry. My grades suck. My GREs are great, but my grades suck. I don't get in anywhere. And I go to and technically I'm a biochemistry major, but I was applying to graduate schools in chemistry because it seemed more closer to what I was interested in. Uh-huh. I certainly wasn't interested in this bullshit about what happens to glycine or any other amino acid.
Okay.
I went to the advisor there, and I said to him, so what am I going to, I was rejected by all the graduate schools I applied to. I said, so what am I going to do? Nobody wants me. And he says, that's not true. Uncle Sam, he wants you. Now, this is, the height of the Vietnam War.
Sure.
So I just walked out of his office. I didn't really say anything.
So you weren't too enthused about...
And I can guarantee, at one point, obviously the university there... I mean, the University Alumni Magazine just did a very nice spread on me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, for years they would ask me for money, and, I would tell them, you want money from me? I mean, get it from this asshole, because he was, as far as he was concerned, I could come back from Vietnam as a putrefying corpse in a body bag. He wouldn't have given a shit.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that was his advice.
Huh.
And so once I sent them a check for 2 cents, which they refused to say, this, more than repays the... care and interest of all the faculty there. Now, that wasn't entirely true at the very end, right? So when I was rejected, I didn't quite know what to do. One of my friends said, well, why don't you see if you can get at least into the biochemistry department in Chicago, which is a pretty crappy department in those days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had one or two guys who may have been okay. They were kind of schmucks from what I can tell. But there was a new graduate student advisor there, somebody who hadn't been around on my first round. And he... a guy named John Law, and he got me into the crystallography biochemistry program at Pitt, and that kind of launched me. So he was the only person who actually ever did me any favors in what turned out to be 5 years that I was at Chicago, because I did that year again. I didn't do much better that
time. Now, you had family connections to your mom still in Pittsburgh, or had that sort of gone by the wayside?
My Pittsburgh relations had nothing to do with that. That was just coincidence.
Okay. So two questions, actually, which or 2 points. So first of all, I went to Pitt as an undergrad.
Oh, yeah.
And second of all,
what years were you there?
I was there. I know this. 85 to 89.
Okay, so many years later.
Yeah, but my major was materials science. So I have to say, when you talk about crystallography, just for the sake of the interview, I'm thinking face center cubic, metallic crystal structures.
So I was doing biological.
So I'm going to have to work to get my head around the idea of organic crystallography, because when I think of it, I tend to think of it in terms of, perovskites and whatever.
Yeah, right.
So,
okay,
anyway.
So a molecular crystal is, I'll show you a picture later of a molecular crystal, which actually influenced me a lot, even though it's a piece of art. So this was biological crystallography. This was in the era. So I went there in 67, and that was about the time that the third protein structure had been done.
Hmm.
Okay, we're not counting DNA, about which I knew what it was by then. but and what its structure more or less was by mm-hmm. then. But by that time, you know, myoglobin, hemoglobin had been had their crystal structures done. Lysozyme had been done, and so the first two were at Cambridge. Next one was Oxford. The first American structure, or that I know of, was ribonuclease. That was done in Buffalo, but I'm not quite sure when carboxypeptidase was done at Harvard.
Okay.
But it's, so, but you know, that, it was the era when protein crystallography was starting to take off, and I didn't really. That was the justification, I believe, for Pittsburgh putting together this biochemistry crystallography training grant.
Okay.
So they had a training grant there. They needed warm bodies. I was the kind of person who, you know, even though I was a shitty student, you know, I seemed to have, you know, a sort of mathematical inclination.
Mm-hmm.
You needed some kind of talent in that direction to, you know, to make it in that business.
Okay.
So I went off to Pitt then in the fall of 67.
Okay.
And, you know, and was out of there by 70. I mean, I was all done in 3 years.
3 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I didn't do all that much. I did a crystal structure of an amino acid, non-standard amino acid. I was interested in phasing. So phasing, although I never, you know, made any impact in the field. But you know, I knew enough about it that I was a good phaser when it came to actually solving crystals.
What is phasing?
Okay, so when you collect a diffraction pattern, mm-hmm. what you've got there is the... Just stop me if I say something you don't understand.
Okay.
You've got the Fourier transform of the power spectrum
okay.
of the structure, all mm-hmm. right? So no phase. So it's, you know... each of these guys call it F, so
yeah.
F is a complex number, right?
Mm-hmm.
F e to the I alpha, you know, of that F is F sub H e to the I alpha H.
Okay.
All right, and you know, H is a three-dimensional vector, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there's one corresponding to every one of these little spots in the diffraction.
Okay.
And what you collect is the it corresponds to the amplitude. F,
mm-hmm.
you know, squared, you know, e to the I alpha times e to the I minus alpha.
This is bringing back all these, like,
yeah.
buried memories of,
right.
of X-ray diffraction classes.
Right.
Yeah.
So you lose the phases.
Okay, I remember hearing a lot about phase spaces in undergrad.
That's different.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Phase space has to do with, you know, directions and... you know, X, Y, Z, and momenta.
Okay.
For every particle in an ensemble of whatever.
So, okay.
That's different.
Okay.
This is just they call you know every, each of these observations you know has an amplitude
mm-hmm.
and a phase associated with
okay.
it. So the amplitude is some length,
mm-hmm.
and the phase is some angle between 0 and 360.
Okay.
All right. And you lose that information
mm-hmm.
completely, but you can derive that in various ways from the data
mm-hmm.
because there are certain, but both from the fact that it's the power spectrum,
mm-hmm.
You can kind of work backwards from the power spectrum to the structure, because it, you know it turns out that the power spectrum is you know kind of the convolution of the structure with itself,
okay,
or with its enantiomorph really. But we don't have to go into that
okay.
too much detail. But I was good at it.
A couple questions along that lines. I'm guessing you're someone who's very good about visualizing objects in space. That's
yeah, I'm pretty good at three space. Yeah.
Okay. And the other question I had is, and this is a real naive question, but I need to ask it, what's the main difference between inorganic crystallography and organic crystallography?
Well, from the point of view of the X-rays and the analysis,
mm-hmm.
you know, not much.
Okay.
It's just a matter of what you're making your crystals out of.
Okay.
And otherwise, it's you know there's no real difference at all. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's just crystalline matter. All right.
Okay.
So crystalline matter is matter. Let me just show you the picture
mm-hmm.
that you know sort of inspired my field and you know did every it's like you know the motion picture. Important picture of my life. It's an Escher, okay?
This is the Escher depth picture.
Yeah, you know it?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just talk about that one for
okay.
a second. And then you'll see what I mean here.
Okay. So just for the record, this is the Escher print depth, and I can't recall the year. Is it
my year or his year?
No, his year.
What, I have no idea what his year was.
Okay.
But I mean, it's out there. I just
remember. But this is sort of the 3D fish is how I think of it.
Yeah, it's a 3D fish.
Okay.
And we'll talk later about
how
some had impact on my thinking. But you can see that there's periodicity front to back, periodicity top to bottom, periodicity left to right.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. So that's what a molecular crystal looks like.
Okay.
And you know, it always pissed me off that in freshman chemistry and introduction to whatever in physical sciences, they show sodium chloride.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because that's in its own way a much more complex notion than this.
Mm-hmm.
Because here, all you have to think about are these fish in three dimensions. I've had to spend a lot of time in San Francisco. You drive in from the airport.
Mm-hmm.
There's some military cemetery there. That's a two-dimensional crystal.
Mm-hmm.
Just headstone, 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 headstone in this row,
yeah.
And then another row and another row. So 2D rather than 3D.
Okay.
You just imagine stacking these dudes up, and you got a 3D crystal.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. What the material is, whether it's inorganic stuff, whether it's fish, whether it's proteins and ribosomes or DNA motifs or what have you, it's strictly a matter that it repeats in a simple periodic fashion.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't talk about the quasi crystals that got somebody Nobel prizes here or whatever.
Okay.
That's a more complex.
Okay. Fashion. So what when you're training to become a crystallographer around 1970, how does one learn how to do it? I mean, what's the process?
You solve crystal structures. Yeah, I took a couple courses.
Okay.
There were four courses in the series I took, and it was great because they were offered at night. And I'm a night person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm nocturnal and a night person.
Yeah.
Nocturnal in the sense I prefer to work after dark, and a night person in the sense that the better half of my day is the second half of my day rather than the first half of my day.
Okay.
So the courses were offered like 7:30 or 6:30 at night. So I actually didn't do so badly in them.
Yeah.
And there were two courses in what's this all about?
Mm-hmm.
And then a course in sort of advanced diffraction theory, which I can repeat a couple things but don't really remember much. And then a course in biological crystallography, which was totally meaningless. So you take courses, but science is learned by doing. So I was given a relatively simple crystal structure to solve, and it took me about 3 weeks to do it, and I did it. And then the other thing I learned, at Chicago, the one thing that I learned two things at Chicago, actually a third thing, but the first thing was that A pairs with T and G pairs with C, okay? I mean, the second thing was an experimental thing that I didn't really realize that I had learned until I saw one of my students doing it wrong, which was just simply mixing something. And thirdly was I learned how to write code.
Okay.
Fortran code. It was still the only language I speak besides English. I can read a little French.
And this would be stuff that would then go to a mainframe.
In those days, a mainframe. I don't know what it was like at Pitt in the 80s, but
we were just starting to get fax machines.
Yeah, we had, and there was an IBM. It was an IBM 1130 in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where Thaw Hall is?
Oh yeah,
So that's where I was.
I had classes in Thaw Hall.
Okay, I was on the third floor of Thaw Hall, and at least in my era, Thaw Hall was a building without the door. Right? You either went in through engineering or you went in through space.
Okay.
And you know who Harry K. Thaw was?
That I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting, because he was... actually, I don't know which Thaw the building was named after. Right?
Uh-huh.
Probably the father. But he was some young robber baron's son. And are you familiar with the movie The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was Harry Thaw, the guy who shot Stanford White, the architect.
Okay.
Because he was jealous of his earlier affair with Evelyn Nesbitt.
Huh.
I may have even seen it when I was in Pittsburgh. I'm not sure. I mean, just by chance. But, you know, local figure, if not hero.
Yeah. I had no idea that's what the building was named after.
Yeah. I think it was his father. You know, interesting. He gave the bucks for that.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so I was in Thaw Hall, and my official boss there was a reasonably distinguished guy, the name of G.I. Jeffrey. But when I first got there, I was working for some assistant professor who was, you know, didn't get tenure, and was sort of stupid. But he had struck up a relationship with Klaus Hoffman, who didn't die all that long ago, who was an old-time protein chemist, you know, the kind of guy who could make a peptide, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like a 20-mer, 30-mer peptide.
Yeah.
And he was exploring ribonuclease, and what he did that was related to me was he substituted, there's an active site there that involves two histidines, mm-hmm. one of which is on this thing called the S-peptide, and the other which is on the bulk of the rest of the protein. It's got 100 and some odd amino acids on it. And the S-peptide is about 20. And at position 12 is a histidine.
Mm-hmm.
And he replaced this histidine with he replaced the imidazole with a pyrazole. So this was called pyrazole alanine. And that was my first crystal structure. So it had no heavy atoms on it. I became a little bit of a snob about not doing crystal structures with heavy atoms in them. And then I saw this in about 3 weeks. And then afterwards I wrote a lot of code,
mm-hmm.
Because we got this 1130 in the lab, and it had replaced an old IBM 1620
mm-hmm.
that I didn't really know how to program very well. I mean, I could program it, but it was an older computer. It was, in fact, I think, it was sort of organized in some sort of decimal fashion. I don't remember exactly what the difference mm-hmm. was. But the 1130 was like, you know, the next generation.
Yeah.
And occasionally I would write something, but not very much, for the 7090 that was in the cathedral.
Yeah.
So, you know, you had to go up to the seventh floor to submit your jobs then. I managed to get myself appointed to as the student representative to the Computer Users Committee there. And I was able to get them to actually let us submit our jobs
mm-hmm.
after midnight when it closed. They could, you know, these professors didn't understand how we all worked.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, what are you going to do if you get your job in at midnight? I mean, I said, well, you know, we could go home instead of having to wait till late in the morning to get the answer.
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, okay. Huh. You know, so we actually were able just to stack up the job and then pick them up when they came in the next day. Because
yeah.
There's some jobs, if the job would take less than 15 minutes, you could run it any time of day.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was over 15 minutes, it could only run after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you had to submit the jobs after midnight.
The ability to do coding, was that common for people doing crystallography, or were you?
In that area,
it was.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, coding in that era was sort of like, 20 years earlier, electronics had been,
mm-hmm.
and 20 years earlier than that, in chemistry, glass blowing had been.
Okay.
And, you know, you saw certain amounts of that all the way along the line.
Sure.
I never learned anything about electronics, but I wasn't bad on, I was a pretty good coder.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I was a good coder, but I was, you know.
Yeah.
I was certainly competent and enjoyed it.
What was the X-ray diffraction equipment like you were using?
I mean, okay, so I used a, at that era, I used primarily there were, of course, cameras around,
mm-hmm.
Where we could take preliminary photographs to characterize our crystal. But I used a four-circle diffractometer that was, it was a Picker diffractometer. I forget the model name of that one. I think it was just the Picker diffractometer,
mm-hmm.
four-circle. And it was run off of IBM cards.
Hmm.
It was connected to a card reader. Did you ever use a card reader?
I've seen them.
Okay. Or, a key punch.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So the key punch had a read station and a write station.
Okay.
And in, you know, the other half of the lab where we had the computer, could punch. We never printed anything out on the computer because time on the computer was so valuable. We had a lister that was just wired up. I mean, it could do some calculations, but we never used it for that. We had real computers by then. But we could list things on it, and we could also just punch directly. So there was a program there. I mean, there was a real coder for what everybody else did, all right, and for what I did too, for the most part. But you know, he was a professor, and you know, he made sure everything was right. But you know, I was a student. You know, most of what I did was more or less right, not very efficient, and. What we would do is we would punch out the instructions to the diffractometer and stack them up in the card deck. You know, where on an ordinary key punch, you just have blank cards.
Yeah.
And then this thing, you know, some signal would come from the diffractometer. I've just completed doing whatever I'm supposed to be doing. Give me my next instruction. So two cards would come down, and the first one would be read, and then it would be reproduced, and only about the first 40 or 50 columns were there, which gave the various angles that this thing, it was an Eulerian cradle, okay?
I'm sorry, what?
It's an Eulerian cradle, so it was a circle with, it was a big circle, you know, like this, and then there was a small circle hanging off of it that changed its orientation, and then there was a third circle down here that changed the angle of the detector. And then on the other end was the X-ray source.
What was the source?
It was for, that was a matter of some controversy. but by and large, we used copper.
Okay.
I mean, I had this assistant professor was retarded, and he wanted to use like molybdenum. Which, you know, I mean, when you're doing biological crystallography, what you want is intensity, and you don't worry about diffraction effects, you know, absorption and extinction, crap like that. Not on the first pass, anyway. What you care about is intensity. Copper's radiation is 1.54 angstroms, intensity proportional to wavelength Q.
Yeah.
Molybdenum is approximately half of that,
0.707.
And 0.70 something. Anyway, 7071, yeah. And that was, you know, so that's, you know, half as much, you get about the tenth the intensity.
Okay.
You know. But anyway, so we use a closed X-ray tube. It's just a local source. I mean, I don't even have X-ray equipment here. When I need to do X-ray crystallography, I go to Brookhaven. Use the synchrotron.
Wow, that's a big change.
It's a huge change.
Interesting.
And, I mean, some people do have local sources. For me, crystallography until recently wasn't that much in my program yet, or again, and I didn't, and it wasn't worth the investment.
Okay. So, what was your PhD research specifically?
Okay, so I did the crystal structure of this amino acid.
Okay.
I did the crystal structure. I was involved in. I sort of worked out how to solve the crystal structure of a sugar, because there's a program on those in the lab. And I wrote this piece of code, and I failed to solve the structure of a short peptide. And that was my research. And but I learned a lot, you know. And then when I went off of my postdoc, I was in a position to solve some problems that otherwise probably wouldn't have been solved without me, without sounding too pompous about that. The first thing I solved was, I mean, I went off to Columbia for my first postdoc.
You were Columbia, then MIT, right?
Yeah.
So how many years at each?
21 months at Columbia, 62 at MIT.
Okay.
So at Columbia, I mean, I went there because I was interested in the protein folding problem. And almost as soon as I got there, I realized that I was working for a bunch of bozos who didn't know shit from Shinola about protein folding or mm-hmm. about chemistry or about anything. They had come from physics, kind of. And, you know, there was this generation of people who came from physics to biology and really created the molecular biology revolution, mm-hmm. you know, starting with Crick and...
people like Schrodinger.
Well, Schrodinger wrote his book.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and everybody read his book. I mean, when I was a postdoc, I read his book, too.
Okay.
And I was, you know, incredibly impressed mm-hmm. with the notion, which I think actually originated with Dalbrook, that genetic material would be an aperiodic crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Jesus, you know, if anything describes DNA, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But Schrodinger didn't actually do any work.
Right.
I mean, you know, people like Crick, I think Minot, but I'm not sure. Certainly Dalbrook.
Yeah.
And others, you know, and this idiot that I worked for at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they didn't understand anything about chemistry. They didn't understand about lone pairs. They didn't understand about the directional nature of hydrogen bonding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of the things that are ultimately going to, you know, have proved or are going to prove incredibly important in solving the protein folding problem, if it's ever solved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, while I was at Columbia, I realized, somebody actually pointed out to me, I wasn't smart enough to pick it up myself, that if in the structure of insulin,
mm-hmm.
which had been solved in 69 by Dorothy Hodgkin's group mm-hmm. finally, the six subunits, in fact, only had trigonal symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
So they were made of two different dimers.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Well, doesn't that mean that the structure isn't 100% determined by the sequence?"
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit! Yeah, I'm wasting my time here. I mean, I knew that anyway because they were yo-yos there. They just wanted to use me as a handy dandy postdoc programmer.
Oh.
They didn't care about science.
So they had a very much more physics approach to looking at.
No, they had a bullshit approach to it.
Okay.
It wasn't physics. Physics, okay. I could appreciate.
Okay.
This was total bullshit. They want the asshole who ran that laboratory, really, you know, wanted to rule the world from 8K. I mean, you know, he didn't really understand what was going on.
From 8K?
That was the size of a small computer.
Okay.
he was just a total jerk.
Okay. So you left there and you went to MIT.
Was that
a happier experience?
A much happier experience.
Okay.
At least the first couple of years, and then the game changed. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, first couple of years, you know, I was there. I mean, I was doing more of the same. I mean, at Columbia, I saw this dinucleoside structure, which, you know, had been sort of hanging out for about 4 years
mm-hmm.
because nobody else could solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to MIT and I solved two more, and then a third one. And the first of those that I solved was the first demonstration of, I was working with other people, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody would argue that I was the central character, that the most important of those actually demonstrated for the first time Watson-Crick AU-based pairing, or AT-based pairing,
mm-hmm.
It happened to be a U, but there had been like 20 unsuccessful attempts to co-crystallize A and T, and they never came up with Watson-Crick-based pairing. So I was working on a bigger fragment,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, took such skills as I had in those days to solve, and once it was solved, then that was the answer.
Hmm.
And, you know, so we confirmed the Watson-Crick hypothesis, basically, in terms of the details of the hydrogen bonding.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew it was A and T. Everybody believed that it would be this form of base pairing because the two base pairs were isomorphous.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing that was ever seen in a single crystal was the so-called Hoechstein base pair.
What's this?
So the Hoechstein base pair is... the Watson-Crick base pair has a six-membered ring over here for the T,
mm-hmm.
and a six-membered ring and a five-membered ring for the A.
Okay.
And they pair over on the six-membered side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in Hoechstein base pairing, this guy donates over to the to the other side
mm-hmm.
of the six-membered. I can show you a picture if you want to see.
Is it a bit like a covalent bond with the sharing? No, not at all.
Okay. Let me just
sure.
get you a picture of this. product into it. So, your ordinary Watson Creek base pair looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
Where the donation is to the six-membered ring, and then it accepts over here on the oxygen. In the Hoogsteen base pair, the donation is to this nitrogen, and then the other hydrogen on that same amino group accepts.
Okay.
All right? Or, sorry, donates to the T. And this is what we'll see in most of those structures.
Okay,
and you can actually get this triple helix, but that's a that's a separate issue.
Okay. So, in order to do that kind of research, how do you go? You know, how are you going about doing it? I mean,
single crystal crystallography, right?
And
again, I was the guy who solved the structures. I didn't grow the crystals. I didn't do squat.
I guess that's sort of what I'm saying. So, where would you get the crystals from?
Well, somebody had to buy. Basically, because none of us were chemists.
Okay.
Somebody had to buy it. Again, it was a crystal that had been hanging out for years and years and years.
Uh-huh.
The data had been hanging out. It wasn't very good data.
Mm-hmm.
Because at MIT, my boss was at the time involved in the crystal structure in a very competitive race for the crystal structure of transfer RNA, in which I was not involved.
Okay.
Until the very end. I was a kind of a spear carrier on that project. And, you know, they gave these crystals to a graduate student who was very smart but never seemed to be able to do anything experimentally.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't let him on the diffractometer.
Mm.
So what he did was to collect the data on film, and it was crappy data.
Mm-hmm.
And one day the boss was out of town, the guy who ran the diffractometer, said, listen, we should do this guy a favor, and he collected the data on the diffractometer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got interested in it.
Okay.
And then eventually, you know, I got the structure got solved.
Okay.
And then and the boss was not happy at all.
Uh-huh.
because it was kind of a major thing.
Yeah.
You know, I and the strategy student wound up with our pictures on the AP wire and so forth for all this. I mean, you know, if you do something at NYU, nobody gives a fiddler's fuck. But if you do something at MIT, I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
I remember my boss was also involved at one point in coming up with anti-sickling agents. And he came up with about the fourth or the fifth of these things, you know, of the same ilk. And it wasn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, I mean, did that one get emblazoned on, you know, at least in the local media, perhaps on some of.
Could you say something about the, I mean, you were at Pitt and Columbia at MIT at interesting periods of time for those institutions. I mean, yeah. I know.
Not Columbia. It wasn't interesting.
Okay. But, I mean, can you just kind of give me a sense of what the.
Well, at Pitt, you know, it was a first-class crystallography lab. It was the only crystallography department in the Western Hemisphere at the time.
Huh.
It doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
Because they decided that, you know, something that didn't have an undergraduate program shouldn't exist. So they had trittered the program down to one guy, and they told him, well, you can either teach a class of 400 screaming protoproctologists, or you can retire. So he retired. He had a farm, it turned out, in, Indiana, Pennsylvania?
Yeah.
Okay, so he had a farm out near there.
Yeah.
So he moved whatever was left of the lab out to Indiana, Pennsylvania, and he worked out there for a few more years.
Wow.
And I visited out there maybe 3-4 years ago. I gave a talk.
Uh-huh.
And now he's just now he's almost 80.
Yeah.
And he's and his health is not the very best. So he just in the last month has moved to Florida. I haven't even reestablished contact with him.
Okay.
So there's no more crystallography department there. There's still crystallographers at least.
In fact,
ironically, the student who worked with me on this APU structure that I was telling you about, he wound up getting a job at Pitt. So he's on the faculty there. He did something that seemed very important at the time, but it turned out he didn't do it exactly right. And then he got involved with some woman in his lab, and it got messy.
Okay.
So he came home one day and found the locks on his house changed. I don't want
to. That sounds bad.
Yeah, it was not a good story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so at Pitt at the time, it was a great place to learn to do crystallography. Mm-hmm. You know, as it, to learn to do the technical aspects of crystallography. I mean, there are some notable people who came out of there. You know, not just me. I mean, there's Sung Ho Kim, who actually was the leader of that tRNA project at MIT. He wasn't the boss. He was like, you know, the straw boss. Mm-hmm. And who's, you know, a member of the National Academy. He's at Berkeley and whatever. Mm-hmm. There was Helen Berman, who, to all intents and purposes, founded the Protein Data Bank.
Oh, yeah, I know that name. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And she's still a good friend. She's at Rutgers. And then there was a little bit junior to me. We shared the office with George Detita, who ran the Hauptmann Woodward Institute in Buffalo for many years, and he was a student of this guy who just moved to Florida, Brian Craven. Mm-hmm. So the boss there was a guy named George Allen Jeffrey, mm-hmm. and he was a very good crystallographer. It's not. I mean, he did a couple of things that were well known. He was a very solid crystallographer, and he established this laboratory that was really, you know, I mean, out of nowhere. I mean, they basically gave him a department at Pitt ultimately.
Okay.
It became a department while I was there. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was the crystal. Pitt had. I mean, many institutions have a mechanism for a pre-department. Mm-hmm. In Pitt, they call it a laboratory. In Chicago, they used to call it a committee.
Okay.
And then at some point, the committee on blah, blah, might become the department of blah, blah.
Okay.
And at Pitt, it was the laboratory of, it would become, you know, so the crystallography laboratory became the crystallography department.
Okay. So what were the sorts of publications or conferences or professional societies, say, in the early 70s that you were going to? I mean, what was it like to be
in the early 70s, I mean, I was a very hardcore crystallographer.
Okay.
So I went to the American Crystallographic Association.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, what I'm telling you about is sort of like the first half of my non-independent career, mm-hmm. right? So 3 years at Pitt, 2 years, maybe it's a little more than the first half, about two years at Columbia, where the emphasis was basically molecular graphics, not crystallography, mm-hmm. and a really childish approach to using computers in other things. And then the first 2 years at MIT. Mm-hmm. Around 74, the game started changing. My game started changing.
Hmm.
Okay, I mean, while I was at MIT, it was very exciting in many respects because the tRNA structure came out, you know, mm-hmm. crystallographically. I did these two or three crystal structures. I'll tell you about the third one of those in a moment.
Okay.
And because that influenced me almost more than the other two, and because it was a failure. There was a lot of molecular biology going down there that was really exciting.
Okay.
Okay. So there were two groups. This was Alexander Rich's laboratory at MIT. And Alex was just here, actually, on a Friday for something. He's still active. He's 87.
Uh-huh.
And he had two groups. He had his crystallography group over here. I mean, he more than almost anybody maintained the two thrusts of molecular biology that had made molecular biology what it was in the 50s and 60s,
mm-hmm.
Namely the sort of molecular biophysics on the one hand and the molecular genetics on the other.
Okay.
You know, there was apparently a Festschrift for Dalbrook that was reviewed, I think, in Scientific American by John Kendrew.
Yeah.
Which was sort of the opening shot in a war,
mm-hmm.
Where basically it was a book that it was called like Phage and the Origins of Molecular Biology, mm. and it was all molecular genetics, no molecular biophysics.
Hmm.
And Kendrew, who you know who he was,
yeah,
okay, so he just lambasted the book, saying, "Listen, you know, yeah, molecular genetics is important and all that, but." So was the molecular biophysics. Uh-huh. So Alex kept both groups going in his laboratory.
Okay.
He had a group of biochemists, people who did things with the molecules, mm-hmm. And then he also had crystallographers.
Okay.
And over the course of 5 years in his lab, the groups waxed and waned.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he brought in a whole bunch of crystallographers in 1974, but they weren't very talented, in my mm-hmm. opinion. And so I used to hang out more with the biochemists or the virologists, or whatever, you know, molecular biologists, who were much more fun. And they had a practice of every day they would do their experiment in the morning, which, you know, usually started in that lab around 11 or 12,
huh.
And they would get it all ready to go by 4 o'clock. They'd put their gel on at 4 o'clock. It would run for about 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'd all go over to the Muddy Charles pub and wait for the gels to run.
Mm-hmm.
And even I did a little gel running when I mm-hmm. in my last years there. And so that's where I learned all my molecular biology. But I remember going over there one day, and, you know, there's Phil Sharp and his group celebrating mm-hmm. because they've just discovered splicing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, it was splicing. Yeah. You know, he later got Nobel Prize for that. And you know, and there were other, you know, talented people there. But that's where the interesting stuff was going on then. It wasn't so much going on at that point in the structural biology.
Okay.
So I keep saying the game changed in 74.
Yeah, I want to hear.
Let me talk about 74. All right. At the start of 74, I spent all 73 trying to solve a crystal structure that would have another one of these dinucleosides that I worked on,
mm-hmm.
plus an intercalator. That's a flat drug that goes between the bases, unwinds them. So normally the bases look like this,
mm-hmm.
and then you unwind them,
okay.
and stick the drug in there.
Okay.
And that was used to some extent. Those kinds of drugs were used to some extent to work out the fact that there were three bases in the genetic code, because
mm-hmm.
you know, you would get these frameshift mutants if you hit the cell with that,
mm-hmm.
and you'd find three frameshifts, and you'd get something like a revert. Right?
Okay.
So that was how Crick worked it out. I mean, you know, Karana and the others did it in other ways.
Uh-huh.
But I was just trying to get the crystal structure of this. And I mean, I kind of knew this was the hardest of all those that I actually solved. And I kind of knew ahead of time that I didn't have the right cell dimensions to get what I wanted to see. And in the end, in the same way that the crystal structure that I did get that showed that the Watson Crick base pairing was a lucky punch, this was an unlucky punch. And that influenced me very much. That, you know, I didn't want to be the victim of crystallization conditions.
Okay.
Right. What I wanted to do was control what I was going to look at in a crystal.
Okay.
And that's still true. So, you know, and then the other part of this, that was one influence.
Mm-hmm.
The other influence was that, you know, they kind of phasing macromolecules wasn't a big deal now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sooner or later you'd get a derivative, and sooner or later, because it's done a different way
mm-hmm.
From the sort of thing that I was doing. And sooner or later you get your derivative, and sooner or later you solve the structure, and you don't have to be smart. You have to be smart, good at,
mm-hmm.
which I never was growing crystals, convincing these damn things to come down in whatever molecule it is you're interested
mm-hmm.
in, to come down in this periodic array that looks like the fish there.
Yeah.
Right. And I sucked at this.
Right? Okay.
I mean, I never really had to do it until I was on my own, you
mm-hmm.
know, 10 years after I started,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't any good.
Okay.
And I didn't have any, I mean, we will get into that in more detail when we
mm-hmm.
get to my Albanian period, but I didn't really have any talent for this at all, and I didn't have a labor force to do it either.
Okay.
Up in Albany.
So you're learning to do this yourself then, eventually.
Well, I didn't learn how to do it. Let's be blunt, I failed.
Okay.
Okay. But by 74, you know, about 3 years before I left Alex's lab,
mm-hmm.
it was clear that this was the way the game was going.
Hmm.
People that, you know, who did do it, you know, some I respected, some I didn't respect,
mm-hmm.
but by and large, you know, these were your crystal growers were far more important than the people who were, in fact, who could, like, solve problems and stuff like that.
Okay.
I mean, in a sense, getting stuff to crystallize is a problem,
mm-hmm.
but you really have no idea what you're doing wrong. I mean, I've done a lot of experiments in this lab. Although, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, till I set up on my own, I had never done any experiment other than the X-ray diffraction experiment. Right? Mm-hmm. And I knew how to do that experiment pretty well. Mm-hmm. But it was the only one I ever designed. Now, since then, I've done many, many, many experiments in this laboratory because we've done many, many things besides crystallography. Mm-hmm. And in all those experiments, you might have a half a dozen different parameters, all of which have to be optimized before you've created the window for in parameter space mm-hmm. for you to be able to do your experiment and do it right. You need the right temperature, the right concentration of okay. ions, the right concentration of DNA, the right concentration perhaps of some protein, mm-hmm. The right identities of cations, mm-hmm. blah, blah, all right?
You know, so producing the material that you want to study is the...
No, I'm talking about designing an experiment now.
Okay.
All right?
Okay.
In any experiment, you have to have the right conditions,
mm-hmm.
all right? But in any of the other experiments, those are independently optimizable parameters.
Okay.
You know, what should be the right temperature? What mm-hmm. should be the right... I mean, pH isn't usually a problem for most mm-hmm. of what we do. But what's the right temperature? What should be the right magnesium concentration?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what should be the DNA concentration? What should be, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Those are independent parameters. You can, you know, maximize the quality of your result along the temperature axis, along the cation mm-hmm. Concentration axis,
mm-hmm.
along the DNA concentration axis, mm-hmm. and so forth. Maybe, you know, in 4, 5, 6 dimensions.
Right? Okay.
You know, when you get all done, you might want to, you know, go to that joint maximum and maybe mm-hmm. tweak it a little bit. You know, and then you can run your experiment and get a result that you can believe.
Mm-hmm.
With crystallography, those are not independent.
Okay.
If you have everything right but one parameter,
mm-hmm.
you don't know.
Huh.
Okay. You just fail.
Okay.
So think of it like opening a safe.
Uh-huh.
Right. You got 100 numbers on the dial,
mm-hmm.
and you got, say, 5 numbers in your combination,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's 10 to the 10th possible combinations.
Mm-hmm.
What a safecracker, from what I can tell, does is he takes a stethoscope and he listens.
Hmm.
And when he's listening, he can hear what happens on the first round.
Mm-hmm.
He hears tumbling slipping into place and so forth. That means he only has to go around once
mm-hmm.
to find out which of those 100 numbers is the right one. Then he goes back. So he, instead of having to test 10 billion possible combinations,
mm-hmm.
he has to test at most 500
mm-hmm.
possible combinations.
Okay.
And that's, you know, basically factoring that product.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what you can do in every other experiment except the crystallization experiment.
Okay.
Okay. Crystallization experiment, you don't have a safe that's talking back to you.
Okay.
So, you know, somewhere out there in those 10 million combinations,
yeah.
there's the right answer.
Right.
Probably.
So you could have all the variables right except one, but you're not going to know which of those is not...
You don't know which of them is wrong?
Uh-huh.
And you don't know if you have all of them right except one. You could have all of them wrong.
Okay.
I mean, you know, there's just no hint.
So you could have 5 of the variables wrong and you're not sure.
You can't tell the difference between 1 wrong and 5 wrong.
Okay. Well, I mean, that begs the obvious question, which is, so how does anyone ever get it right?
Lots of trial and error.
Okay.
It's all trial and error.
Huh.
In all of it.
Okay.
And that's what we're trying to eliminate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And at least in one case we have, but sort of.
Okay.
Okay. But that's the whole point.
Uh-huh.
The fact that I couldn't really grow crystals
mm-hmm.
and the fact that I had that failure in trying to get into the intercalator thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, made me kind of a control freak. Okay. So the crystallographic game changed.
Okay.
That was the key point.
And this is all happening around 74. And
around
74,
75, 76.
Yeah.
77, I left Alex's lab.
Okay.
For the only fucking job I could get, this dump up the river in SUNY Albany.
Yeah, I gathered from the few things I've read and the various interviews, you didn't like Albany very much.
Albany sucked.
Okay.
All right? That's the kindest thing I've ever said.
Okay. As the city or the institution or just...
Everything there sucked.
Okay.
Okay. When I got there, I mean, I just left MIT, which is arguably like living in mental peppermint, okay?
Yeah. And so you're living the dream at MIT, and you...
And then I wind up the river, you know, culturally speaking, you can forget Albany.
Mm-hmm.
All of my colleagues were far more interested in their families than they were in their science.
Okay.
Without question.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Here I am, a single guy, isn't really very interested in families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a cat when I was there.
Okay.
That was it.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And what I want to do is my science.
Mm-hmm.
And all these bozos, you know, were sucking up students like crazy because they were doing molecular genetics, which was easy. It was one-dimensional work. I ultimately had one good friend there. He came out 5 years after I came in biology and other friends.
And you were in a biology department.
I was in the bio department, and boy, was it a biology department. It wasn't like a biochemistry, biophysics, anything department.
Okay.
It was a nightmare. The graduate students were all mathophobic failed pre-meds.
Okay.
Okay. Maybe one or two of them wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But when, I mean, the way I got there was that the chair of the department had been promised a warm body to talk to, and he was a DNA physical chemist.
Huh.
Right? And, in fact, he was the guy who discovered the phenomenon of intercalation.
Okay.
And he was promised a warm body to talk to. It turned out, he wanted a structural thinker, and he wound up with me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only job I could get. I mean, I had a really powerful record. A really strong record, I should say. It was no power because nobody was hiring crystallographers in 1977.
So the job market was terrible.
The job market was awful.
Okay.
I went a year and a half, 9 interviews before I could get this job in this shithole up the river.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about every other year, a student might come along who might want to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was in an active phase of his career. He would just grab them off and say, you know, you're going to be teaching this year, but if you work in my lab, I'll make you an RA. I mean, I couldn't compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was screwed from pillar to post, basically. There was no way I could do crystallography. I mean, I recruited an army of undergraduates, but it was all heat, no light.
Okay.
You can't organize undergraduates. You can't, because they were all pre-meds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only if somebody there had any interest in going to graduate school, I said, all right, you know, so maybe you get a B in a class, you know, my letter might get you into graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all going to medical school. They needed A's.
Okay.
And you couldn't argue with them.
Mm-hmm.
They needed A's. So they couldn't be there to do the next step, or, you know, it was a nightmare, total nightmare, for 7 fucking years.
Okay.
All right?
But
No students.
But you got tenure there eventually, but no students working with you.
I got tenure based strictly on my postdoctoral record. I wouldn't have given me tenure, having, you know, never heard of me before seeing me show up there.
Okay.
Okay? I produced almost nothing.
Huh.
I mean, as a postdoc, I mean, I was really highly respected
as
a crystallographer, and they, in fact... I had this idea at the start of the whole thing. You know the story about the Escher fish.
A little bit. I want to ask you some questions about it. Yeah.
But, I spent the summer of my fifth year, I turned in my tenure package, and I went to Leiden to learn how to make DNA.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to make anything. I was terrified. I mean, I hadn't taken organic chemistry in almost 20 years. I had no idea what the hell I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the end, all I learned was sort of the language. I never actually made anything myself. But I was able to get to the point where I could ultimately make DNA in my own lab.
Okay.
But not by the techniques I learned in Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So this was the summer before the tenure decision, and I come back in August for a week because
mm-hmm.
I did get a grant, and I wanted to have the stuff waiting for me,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I came back for real in September, because the grant started August 1, I wanted to have this stuff waiting for me in September so I could, you know, dive right in and start making DNA and so forth. And also I wanted to make sure my tenure decision was not being derailed. And, you know, first thing I do is I called up a friend of mine who was at Penn, who, and he said, I said, you know, I'm learning to make this DNA. It seems like it's working. I mean, I'm kind of amazed. He said, well, really? That's great. You know, you may be doing that down here. He said, yeah, we may have to hire you, you know, for, you know, as my postdoc or something, because you may not get tenure up there. And, you know, this is because he had been talking to somebody else over in chemistry who had gone to a picnic with the biology chair. And one of my good friends in chemistry was coming up for tenure, and he had he said to the biology chair, we have a really easy tenure case coming up, as my friend.
Yeah.
And he said, but we have a really tough one coming up, Ned.
So word was maybe getting around at that time that, you know, that things weren't looking good then.
Well, but that was before my letters came in.
Yeah.
And my letters were all based on, you know, this guy, you know, is a walks on water scientist, you know, but all based on what I'd done as a postdoc, because I had produced almost nothing. Now, the following winter, I wound up with a Nature paper based on the new program. You know, that was before the decision was made. The decision was already made by then to give me tenure.
Tell me a bit about the funding at this point for your work. I mean, because I've looked through...
Funding is one of the things that I haven't had an awful lot of trouble with.
Okay.
I got a crystallography grant when I first got to Albany. And I also got a starter grant from the March of Dimes.
Okay. Crystallography grant would come from NSF?
NIH.
NIH, okay.
And that crystallography grant, of course, wound up being Deep Six. But I then wrote a grant based on the idea of making stable branch DNA, and we're going to do crystallography on it, we're going to do six gazillion other things with it. That I didn't know how to do. I wrote it with another guy, although I was PI. And that grant came through. And then I had an RCDA, which Research Career Development Award, which was going to cover my salary for the next 5 years after they gave me tenure. So it was, you know, and it meant, you know, this guy is kind of elite, right? So
RCDA is also coming from NIH.
Yeah, you know, also NIH.
Okay.
And I mean the original crystallography grant I submitted it both to NIH and NSF. I got it from both, but NSF was 2 years and NIH was 3 years, and, you know, I mean, no-brainer. Anyway, so I had money then, and then the NIH grant that I'm still going on got funded before. I mean, it was a little tricky because it came out in the first council of the Reagan administration, of the first Reagan administration. And they had, you know, made a decision. They gave me a score of 168 at a time when they were funding, when they thought they were funding down to about 200, 210. And it turned out they went down to 164 that time. And I was fucked. But then you're always held in for three councils.
Okay.
At least in those days you were. I don't know what it is now.
Yeah.
And on the next council, they went down to 168.
Okay.
Survive. So, I mean, I had three more years of work.
When did you hear that on your tenure case, then?
Was that I heard that in probably December the year before.
I mean, the quote that it always makes me laugh, but, you know, I've seen a number of cases where you say, you know, no crystals, no crystallography, no crystallographer. You know, it seems to summarize your feelings about that particular, you know, spot you were in.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
And that's why I was not proposing crystallography. I mean, you know, we did a ton of solution physical chemistry on branched DNA. I don't know, you know, the ultimate value of some of that work. Well, it'll ultimately be decided, you know, sometime after I'm dead. But in the meantime, you know, I did a certain, I mean, this whole program for which I'm known was basically bootleg off of the NIH as well until about 1989. So for about 7 years, it was completely bootleg, and then I started getting support from the Navy.
Okay. And I want to ask you about that when we get to that point in time. But I'm curious, for the NIH, I mean, what were they seeing it in terms of potential benefits or applications? I mean, what was
the NIH is not a benefits applications thing. NIH really wants to solve fundamental biological problems.
Okay.
I had a very I mean, my idea as to how to make stable branch DNA molecules out of oligonucleotides mm-hmm. was basically, you know, which I had in 1979, mm-hmm. and I started writing immediately, and it took about a year and a half till December mm-hmm. of 81 for that money to come through. Mm-hmm. Maybe it wasn't December, maybe it was the council, I guess council, you know, it was April, then it was probably August. Yeah, so it was about August, September, something like that, mm-hmm. of 81. I was getting all ready to, you know, to resubmit that grant, you know, with more calculations, blah, blah. But that wouldn't have done much.
Okay.
Maybe it would have, I don't know. Anyway, and I didn't get the RCDA until just before I came back.
Okay.
But they were seeing this as a way to attack issues of branched DNA. But branched DNA is an intermediate. The holiday, so-called holiday junction mm-hmm. is an intermediate in genetic recombination and to some extent in repair.
Okay.
So our focus is still on that for the NIH. It's evolved a bit in the last decade, and mm-hmm. we can talk about that later.
Okay.
But at any rate, that was what the NIH was expecting to get out of it. Was you know, physical characterization mm-hmm. of aspects of branched DNA.
Okay.
Which, you know, this is DNA branched at the secondary structure level. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So, you know, so we make base pairs that look, you know,
with
like
the
that.
Little, right.
Yeah.
So, at this point, I mean, you were still practicing or learning how to make your own DNA, or had you sort of, where was that?
Okay, so I was basically, at this point we're talking about 82, 83, 84, I was failing to make my own DNA.
Okay.
On the first renewal of the grant, I talked the NIH into giving me a DNA synthesizer.
This was 84? 85, okay.
And I wrote a grant in 84 and mm-hmm. I got it in 85. And that changed my life.
Okay.
I mean, I should point out that, you know, I actually was the guy who used that synthesizer from 85 till 98. Mm-hmm. So for 13 years, I made all the DNA in the lab myself.
What kind of machine was it?
I can show you its successor downstairs. Uh-huh. I barely know how to work it, even though the other one, you know, I could take it apart. It's a solvent programmer, okay?
Okay.
And so there are a bunch of bottles of liquids on there. There are four bottles for the four bases. Mm-hmm. The four bottles on that one had three, four different bases, you mm-hmm. know, 5-methyl-C or a biotinylated group or what mm-hmm. have you, you know. In the original, there was a slightly different chemistry in the original one, so there was a special bottle on there to remove methyls, but we stopped using that bottle years later because mm-hmm. it stunk. There was an impetus to get rid of that type of chemistry and replace it with something that didn't smell bad mm-hmm. because you were always leaking around the edge, and the place smelled, the area around the machine smelled like a wet fart. And then there's another thing there for a catalyst. Mm-hmm. Another bottle there. I'm just going in order. Mm-hmm. I mean, for the last thing, which was just a little ammonium hydroxide, which would take the stuff off the solid support. So you're growing it on a solid support.
Okay.
All right. So you have a little rock there mm-hmm. with the first base on the. Technically, what everybody else would call the last base, but we make it backwards, synthetically, already hanging on there. And then you deprotect that, there's another reagent to deprotect that, mm-hmm. And then it's ready to go. And then you add the next base, and then you do a couple things to it. You oxidize it, and you also so-called cap it. Mm-hmm. So if there's a failure, because there's always a little bit of failure, let's say you're making a 50-mer, mm-hmm. Then, you know, if you fail on the 25th step, mm-hmm. you'll have a 25-mer mm-hmm. there amongst your products rather than a 49-mer that's missing the 25th base.
Okay.
Right? So it's much easier to purify that way. Mm-hmm. So you have some capping reagents in two different bottles, and then you have your major solvent as well.
Okay. And NIH paid for the machine?
NIH paid for the machine.
Okay.
It was about $42,000 or something.
Okay. Was that expensive at the time, or was that?
Yeah, but it wasn't like an X-ray setup, but it was the most expensive piece of equipment in my lab at that time.
Okay.
That question.
Okay. Yeah.
It was a fair amount of money, but I mean, it was absolutely worth it.
Okay.
Both from their point of view and from mine.
Mm-hmm.
We did all sorts of things we'd never have known about it.
How long would it take to grow a sample then?
Okay, so this machine actually could do 3 at a time.
Okay.
And, you know, it depended what you wanted. Most people who make synthetic DNA today want primers. Pull 20 mers, you don't really care how good it is. Mm-hmm. You're missing a couple bases on one and the other, sometimes a little bit. Who gives a shit, you don't purify, you just use.
Mm-hmm.
We're chemists. Mm-hmm. We want everything to be perfect. We want to maximize our yields.
Mm-hmm.
We want everything to be dry and everything else. So I would, and you want to make sure that if you're deep protecting, you know, because the thing is not going to grow. The thing will, to get the thing to grow to the next step, you have to deep protect something so mm-hmm. it's not growing what during the previous
right.
step, right? So as there is more, a longer and longer strand
mm-hmm.
growing on the little rocks in there, and mm-hmm. I said little, I mean like grains of sand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a little more back pressure on the machine,
mm-hmm.
and the deep protection happens a little more slowly.
Okay.
So I would typically do the deep protection step maybe a little bit longer as the strand got longer,
mm-hmm.
that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take maybe 14 minutes per nucleotide.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was making 100, that would go basically four an hour. Mm-hmm. It would go overnight.
Okay.
And I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, all right. I mean, I have a day job, and making the DNA strands was the one thing I did to keep my hand in the lab. I mean, at a certain point, around 98, 99, my time, you know, I started having a bit of my nose stuck above the horizon.
Right? Okay.
And I started traveling more, you know. The lab got a little bigger. I couldn't supply it with all the DNA it needed,
mm-hmm.
and so forth and so on. So I taught other people to do it.
When did you start attracting students? Because I remember you said, you know, said
here.
when you got here.
Yeah, I mean, it was 7 years there. Then I had a master student for 1 year. Then the next year I had a second master student.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed 2 years. He was from Taiwan. He's the guy who ultimately became my first PhD student.
Hmm.
And sometime in the middle of his beginning maybe of his second year, I say to him, well, you know, how'd you like to stay for a PhD? And he said, well, you know, when I was in Taiwan, all American universities same. Now I'm here, all American universities not same. He was a smart guy.
Yeah.
So at the time I was starting my negotiations here,
mm-hmm.
so I said, go to NYU. My colleague with whom I've been working very closely for years had come here as chair of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I got here.
Who is this?
Neville Kallenbach.
Okay.
And I said, go there for a year, work with Neville, and then, if I actually get to NYU, you know, you can come back to me, and if you don't, well, at least you're working with my colleague.
Yeah.
And then the following year,
mm-hmm.
so that same year, that was my 10th year up the river, I got somebody who had been a master student with Lerman, and who had been so pissed off by Lerman that he said, fuck this, I'm going to business school. So he was a local. He was Schenectadian, but he'd gone to college at McGill, and he wound up. How are we doing? We've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
He wound up going to McGill. He can't. He pre-med. The French he learned was huit au coin. You know, eight ball in the corner pocket.
Yeah.
And little else.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, like me, didn't let college interfere with his education. He came to Albany, and, you know, at one point he was working for Lerman, but I was on his committee, so we knew each other.
What's Lerman's first name?
Leonard.
Leonard, okay.
L-E-R-M-A-N, Leonard.
Okay.
And He was in a group meeting with Leonard, and Leonard said to him, well, why did you do, he said something, and Leonard said, well, why did you do it that way? And he said, well, I thought, and Leonard told him, I don't pay you to think, I pay you to do what I tell you to do. Well, so Mueller decided that, you know, maybe this was not for him, and he did hang out for his master's degree, and then he went up to McGill, went to business school,
mm-hmm.
came back. He was very close with his father, so he came back to the Schenectady or Albany area or whatever, mm-hmm. and he went to work for Payne Webber, one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a cold caller for 2.5 years, and about once a year we'd meet for a beer.
Mm-hmm.
And third time we meet for a beer, he says, you know, Ned, it's the line out of Wall Street. I'm selling stuff I don't own to people I don't know. I'm a salesman.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I want more to life than this. Can I come back and work for you?
Mm-hmm.
I said, you betcha. Because he was a smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was my only Albanian PhD student.
What was his first name?
John Mueller.
John Mueller, okay.
M-U-E-L-L-E.
Okay.
And but the other guy was actually my first student,
mm-hmm.
the master's who came here. He got his degree maybe, you know, 6 months earlier.
Okay.
And so he moved with me to New York, although he remained a student up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two of them got their degrees from me, probably both in 91, 92. I know.
Okay.
But anyway.
Well, before we talk about NYU, let's talk about the Escher picture, which I'm sort of calling your Escher epiphany.
Yeah, my Escher epiphany. That's fine.
Yeah.
So what happens is, yeah, I'm not sure if these two stories happened on the same day or not.
Okay.
One day, I mean, my office was on... was sort of in the middle of the building. It's a long, narrow building.
Mm-hmm.
And the men's room was on the end. And one day I'm down in the men's room sitting on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody comes in and says, Ned Seaman in here? I say, yeah. He says, you're my advisor. I said, not when I'm in here. And I don't know if it was just for that reason that I went over to the campus pub just to escape this kind of harassment, or whether that was a different day.
Okay.
I know I certainly went over to the pub to do that, you know, after that event.
Uh-huh.
And it also happens that I went over there to think about Six Arm Junctions.
Mm-hmm.
So while I'm thinking about Six Arm Junctions, I think about... suddenly this thing comes into my head.
No, okay. So where had you seen this before? I mean, were you a big Escher fan, or...?
Every crystallographer is familiar with the Escher oeuvre.
Okay.
I mean, maybe not every, you know...
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, okay. Because so many of Escher's things have to do with periodic...
yeah, they do.
...matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, shape... I mean, so, you know, all of us know... I mean, there is a well-known... in my youth, there was a well-known book by Carolyn McGillivray, who I guess must have had some Scottish ancestors but lived in Holland,
mm-hmm.
Insofar as I know, who wrote a book, The Periodic Aspects of M.C. Escher's Art.
Huh.
And she was a crystallographer. And, there was Escher stuff was all over.
Uh-huh.
You know, your life if you were a crystallographer.
Okay.
And in fact, in 1975, the International Crystallography Meeting, probably I guess it was the third one I went to,
mm-hmm.
was actually in Amsterdam. So, you know, you're kind of inundated with Escher and whatnot.
Okay. Just because of all the artwork having this periodicity to it.
Yeah, it has a lot of mathematical stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, it's periodicity, it's hyperbolic things, it's all sorts of polyhedra.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all, you know, transformations that sort of, you know, could emulate phase transformations. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind you were talking
right,
about.
Right, yeah.
You know, all sorts of stuff, you know, in, you know, the Escher's art. So, I mean, every crystallographer, I used to say Escher is every crystallographer's favorite artist.
Okay.
You know, I mean, apparently amongst artists, he's not thought of as having been that technically wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Beats me.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, you know, there are good stories and there are stories that are well written, right? Mm. And the same thing is true with art, I guess.
Okay.
You know, there's stuff that's smart and then there's stuff that's, you know, super competently executed, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And sometimes there's both.
Okay. So you were familiar then with
I was
the...
very familiar with
okay.
Fisher. And what had happened was, I had been in, you know, when I first realized that I could make immobile junctions, all right, so, you know, so the whole thing about DNA branch junctions mm-hmm. was that in their natural, you know, naturally occurring branch junctions don't sit still. They
okay.
move around.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know about that or not.
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. So I think that may be on, yeah, it's actually on this, so I can show you. Okay, so
these are holiday junctions.
These are holiday junctions.
Okay.
And they come from DNA with the same sequence. You see ATGT, mm-hmm. ATGT like that?
Okay.
It's the same sequence.
Mm-hmm.
This is just an easier way to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So this C is paired to this G and this C to this G.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing to stop it from isomerizing so that this C pairs with this G,
mm-hmm.
this one with that one, and... You know, then you're going up this pathway, or you could go down the other pathway with the T's and the A's.
Okay.
All
right. Now, question. Whenever I would read about holiday junctions, I was trying to understand, does this mean a junction in space in terms of where these are meeting, or is this a junction of sort of like two different chemical pathways that it can go down?
Well, it's... Well, those are two different questions.
Okay.
This is... It's a crossover... It's the molecular version of a crossover event.
Okay.
I mean, did you take biology? You heard
long
about
time ago.
You remember the
from nuns.
Cross? Okay. They probably... They weren't the worst. You know, they probably knew about crossover events.
Yeah.
They probably taught you about it.
Because yeah.
that's how... From crossovers, which were postulated, you know, I don't know, back 100 years ago
mm-hmm.
or something... That was how they were able to map genes, right?
Okay.
You know, what was the frequency of this gene and this gene,
mm-hmm.
you know, both winding up on the same chromosome, opposite chromosomes, whatever. You did these crosses and you figured that out.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, prevailing hypothesis was that you had various crossovers in between
okay.
the gene. And this is sort of a molecular version of that.
Okay.
I mean, I'm simplifying
yeah.
more than is justified, but okay. Anyway, so you have, but this is, you know, one chromosome, this is the other one, and basically they have the same sequence.
Mm-hmm.
It's only very rarely that there's little changes. We can go into details of that, but I don't think you're interested because it doesn't really impinge on my story.
Okay.
But there's this twofold symmetry here in the middle.
Sure.
Okay? And that's what enables this C to pair with this G and this C to pair with this G because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. So I got involved in all of this because of a postdoc of Lerman's by the name of Bruce Robinson.
Mm, okay. I remember coming across his
yeah,
name.
You'll see that name
yeah.
over and over in my stuff. Bruce was an EPR spectroscopist, basically. He does other things.
Electron pair resonance.
Paramagnetic resonance,
yeah.
yeah. But, I mean, what was he measuring? That's the important thing. He was measuring how much DNA librates, librations of a round form of vibration.
Okay.
Right?
So is it moving around an axis?
Yeah,
okay.
moving around an axis. So he measured that. And Lerman said to him, you know, you should figure out, you know, now that you know how much DNA wiggles this way,
mm-hmm.
this impinges on branch migration. That's this thing that I'm showing here.
Okay.
Okay. But it was thought of not so much in this context as in that context, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, so that this thing could zipper up and down.
Okay.
So he said, I can't imagine what that looks like. And Lerman says, well, why don't you talk to Ned? He'll build you a model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Bruce comes in to talk to me, and he builds me a model. And what we recognize is that there's, in fact, a certain asymmetry
mm-hmm.
between what's above this crossover point and what's below it.
Okay.
All right? A way to show that is on another slide. I don't think we need this one anymore. Let me just get to that, go to here. This is one of the few things, worthwhile things, that I got out of Albany. You ever been to that campus?
Never.
Lucky guy. Shithole to work in. It was a really badly designed campus. It was built, it was designed by, God, I've forgotten his name now. The fellow who designed Lincoln Center, Edward Durell Stone. And I mean, the windows were terrible. They were all arrow slits. You couldn't put an air conditioner in one. You know, you had to have a water-cooled air conditioner if you're going to have one. I don't mind that much.
So this was a stairway.
This is a stairwell there. Now, if you think about this in the same context as what I was just showing you,
yeah.
Right? Think of this plateau as being the branch point.
Okay.
Okay. Now, if you and I were walking down these stairs, me down here and you down there, mm-hmm. we'd be facing each other.
Right.
Okay. If I held on to the green banister on this side, and you held on to the green banister on that side, mm-hmm. and continue walking down, our backs would be to each other.
Right.
Okay. In the DNA world, that's the equivalent of the major grooves facing each other. Do you know what a major groove is?
A little bit.
Either you do or you don't.
Not very well.
Okay.
Please tell me.
All right. I'll show you the model. Anyway, this would be the equivalent of the major grooves facing each other above the junction, and the minor grooves facing each other below the junction.
Okay.
So here's a DNA molecule. Right. And you see, the bases in DNA are attached on the same side, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this side over here and that side over there. And the DNA in between here is called the minor groove.
Okay.
Okay. You see, because of this angle
mm-hmm.
between here and I'm losing myself here, between there and there,
mm-hmm.
that's a relatively small angle. It's about 90 degrees. But actually, if you go out, you know, and sort of think about the backbone, it's actually more like 140 degrees.
Okay.
You know, sort of like from the middle of this to the middle of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the other angle that goes the other way around, which is much larger,
mm-hmm.
and that's called the major groove.
No, we're okay. Can you show me where that would be?
Okay, so that would be going around the rest of the way. So you're starting here
uh-huh.
and going around this surface.
Okay. How many degrees is that then?
360 minus 140, whatever that
okay.
is.
Okay. 160.
Yeah. 220.
220. Right.
And actually, that ratio is not too far from the golden ratio, if you want to
uh-huh.
get mystical about it.
Okay.
All right. So there's a major groove and a minor groove. They're chemically different.
Uh-huh.
They're, you know, they're So Bruce and I realized that there was this difference. So you know, here I am, a failed crystallographer. I got a 10-year decision coming up. This is now January 79. I've only been there like 15 months. My lab has not even been set up yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they haven't given me the space yet. They haven't remodeled it for me. So I could run x-rays. It took 20 of the 60 months I had to get tenure just to get space. That was where I could have x-rays and whatever. Not that I was expecting much to happen with the x-rays, because I didn't have any crystals.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares about the x-rays? So I realized, well, gee, you know, I mean, at least I can write code. You know, we can simulate this process.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this asymmetry. So maybe there's something interesting going on here.
Mm-hmm.
To make several long stories short, there was nothing going on.
Mm-hmm.
Technically speaking, it was symmetric. You know, we left out a very important term. I mean, it not much came of it, but it was, you know, it got me thinking about branch DNA.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that what we were doing was, because this is a the stuff can move around
mm-hmm.
like that. What we were really doing was a scholastic rather than a scientific enterprise, and I sensed that, because you know, even if we, you know, sucked a bunch of Holiday junctions out of, you know, some bug or whatever, How are we ever going to test any hypothesis we generated?
Mm-hmm.
Forget about it. You know, let's say we said, okay, branch migration would happen faster if two arms were long and two arms were short. Possible hypothesis, you know.
Right.
Right, wrong, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't test that because we'd have a heterogeneous population of these guys, mm-hmm. All over the place. So, I was not too pleased with what we were doing, but, you know, whatever. So then in March, I go to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I fly to Hawaii with my friend Greg Petsko. I mean, I don't know if you know his name.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you'll undoubtedly do one of these on him. He's a very well-known guy.
What year is this? It's 1980?
79.
So 79, okay.
Yeah. And during the flight, so Greg is a very well-known protein crystallographer at the time. He still is, of course. He does more than protein crystallography now. At the time, he was interested. He's always been a guy with a lot of ideas. One of the ideas he mentioned while we were flying to Hawaii from, he had just moved to MIT, was that he was thinking of seeing if he could mix iron-containing hemoglobin
mm-hmm.
and cobalt-containing hemoglobin to see if he could get a crystal of what would be the intermediate in the oxygenation pathway.
Right.
Because iron changes its spin state and deforms the porphyrin to which I don't know how much of this you know about.
Well, I know iron will react with oxygen and cobalt will react with oxygen at different rates.
Well, this isn't the rates. It has to do with different sizes of the iron-oxygen, I guess, ion.
Okay.
So it isn't so much reaction because you don't actually change you don't change from iron plus 2 to iron plus 3,
mm-hmm.
and God knows what cobalt does in this case, but you change spin states.
Okay.
All right? And the one with it's 5 independent spins, or I think it's 5 independent spins, or it's, one up, one down, one up, one down, and one up.
Okay.
Okay? And the one with the 5 independent spins is bigger,
mm-hmm.
and that deforms the porphyrin.
Okay.
And that doesn't happen with cobalt, apparently.
Okay.
So Greg just, let drop this hint that maybe he would try that experiment someday, and, fine with me. I have no interest in the hemoglobin. But it set a germ in my mind that maybe you could fool a system into giving you an intermediate
okay.
that was stable,
mm-hmm.
right? Where you didn't have to trap it in time, you could trap it by, being clever.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a month later, I'm sitting there talking with one of my undergraduates, who's now a PI on her own, and is coincidentally in Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, isn't there some way we could just get these branch things to not go anywhere? Because
mm-hmm.
I knew in one direction, there's this thing called cruciform extrusion, where if you have supercoiled DNA and you have a palindromic sequence, it will extrude a cruciform. In one direction, then it stops.
Okay.
As you lose the symmetry.
Okay.
So it's local symmetry, but it's not a global symmetry mm-hmm. in the DNA.
Palindromic sequence means just...
You can read it. It's the same sequence going...
Gotcha.
So
like a palindrome.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually technically... A palindrome is technically a mirror, and this is a twofold axis. But yeah, it reads this... One strand reads exactly the same as the other strand.
Okay.
And, suddenly I realized, if you could make the DNA synthetically...
Mm-hmm.
And in 1979, that was a large if, not a small if.
Mm-hmm.
Then you could put together something like this, where you'd have, four different bases flanking the junction.
Mm-hmm.
And, Jesus, I was higher than a kite when I realized that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I immediately built a model, because now I'm starting to think about this, about DNA, as something that we might be able to approach, branch DNA, something we could approach experimentally.
Okay.
So I build models.
When you say you're building a model, are you building a computer model or a physical model?
Physical model.
Okay, like the ones we were just holding.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And so I built a physical model,
mm-hmm.
and there's a visitor to the lab, and And he says, "Yeah, that's kind of neat. Can you make more than four?" I don't know. I'll think about it. So, you know, based on the various rules that I came up with to make four, I realized that you could make up to eight. In fact, you could make more than eight. Now, we've actually made 12 a few years ago. But you can make at least up to eight. So then, you know, I go over to the pub to think about the six armors. And when I'm So I go over to the pub to think about the six armor, and then I think about this. All right, and I think to myself, "Gee, you know, a six arm junction doesn't have to be planar. It can be three dimensional. And if it's three dimensional, I can organize this thing. I mean, we haven't done very much with six arm junctions, to be honest. You know, we made them. We found they were kind of they didn't really have nice structures or anything that we could characterize the solution." And we haven't done too much in 3D with them. It's what we, the ultimate thing we made is six connected. That's something different.
Now, the when I first read the story, the part that intrigued me the most was it reminded me of the story of the discovery of the benzene ring, where he has the dream where he's seen the snake.
The snake follows his tail.
And it reminded me of that.
Yeah, in a way it was. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it was, you know.
You weren't sleeping, obviously. But
I wasn't sleeping. I was drinking, which was better.
Okay.
Just a beer. That's all I drink.
Okay.
But I said, "Gee, you know, I could, if I could organize these guys this way," and you know, in the preceding 3 years, I had had to go to listen to other people's students talk about how they'd made their miserable little construct. Right.
What do you mean by miserable little construct?
They're genetic, genetically engineered constructs.
Okay.
And every one of them had done the same damn thing, and I was bored to tears.
Uh-huh.
What they'd done is they'd taken their plasmid, they'd restricted it, either one or two enzymes, you know what that means?
Yeah.
And then they'd taken their gene, and they'd put it in there, and they had some way of, you know, checking that it was there, and they'd stuck them in there with sticky ends, right? Sticky ends. I was not unfamiliar with sticky ends. So, you know, basically what I needed was somebody to get these guys to talk to one another, and it was immediately obvious that sticky ends was the way to do that. Okay? I mean, that, it was, you know, 1 second.
Okay.
Right? You know, from thinking about the Escher, thinking about that, and then, well, sure, I can hold them together with sticky ends. Bango. All right, that's the rest of my career. More or less. We've done a few other things.
So you're imagining each of those six ends as the sticky end that will then...
I'm imagining the sticky end on this fish's left fin, this fish's right fin, top fin, bottom fin, head and tail.
And those are then going to be the points of contact or the points...
That
of,
was what
the...
was going to hold them together.
Okay.
And we were going to program it and all of that.
Okay. So in 1982, you wrote a paper on nucleic acid junctions...
Yeah. Actually, I wrote the paper earlier, but yeah.
Okay. So I'm trying to get a connection between that paper and this picture that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Okay.
You want me to say something?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is the three-dimensional picture. I mean, if you want, I can drag up that paper.
I have a copy of it here somewhere.
I have it. I know where it is here.
But, so you wrote the paper.
Nucleic acid junctions and lattices.
Yeah. So
I had an earlier paper.
This is in the Journal of Theoretical Biology in 82.
Right.
So I'm guessing you probably submitted it 81 or so by the time it comes out. Or?
Yeah, I submitted an earlier version to a meeting.
Okay.
And then I submitted this. I don't know. It probably says when it was, received in 81, and then revised form in early 82.
Okay.
And it got published, I think, in late 82 because. The proofs arrived while I was in Holland.
Okay, this is when you were in Leiden learning how to make DNA.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, so here's the same picture I just showed you.
Right.
And then, so I had the rules in here as to how to make these things. One of which was, the third of which is totally, somebody told me it's totally redundant, he was right. And then there was the idea of making a partially mobile junction like this, and we've done some of those.
Okay.
Just so we can study the phenomenon of the thing moving. We haven't really done much of that. And then the next part was junctions and networks. So here, these are stereo pictures of three connected, four connected, five. Do you know what connected means in that regard? Yeah, that every vertex is connected to three, four, five, and six other vertices.
Okay. So when this paper comes out, what's the reaction that you get from it? The people?
Reaction? Zero.
Zero. Okay.
No reaction.
All right.
That paper is now, I think, my fifth. I mean, I can show you the citation history on that paper.
It's, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's like that till about 2000.
And then it just goes up.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I don't really know exactly what it is. Now it gets about 40, 50 cites a year. Because it's the paper that I cite.
Okay.
If I'm talking about the notion. I've published many more recent reviews.
But do you see this as sort of the starting point of this whole line of research?
Yeah, this paper, or actually the previous paper that I published in this meeting proceedings, which was much less detailed than this, and the meeting proceedings paper, the meeting proceedings there was no big deal, but. I should point out, this paper was rejected by the lowest ranking journal in terms of quality that exists, BBRC.
BBRC.
Biochem Biophys Research Communications. Okay? And the editor to which I sent it was presumably a friend of mine. And the guy, he undoubtedly was a member of the National Academy or something, but from what I can tell, he was dumber than dog shit, and he didn't understand anything that I was talking about. And in fact, the next paper submitted in this series was also, there was a paper with Neville, and we used to talk about it as the bouncer.
The bouncer.
Because it kept bouncing. And
from where to where?
Well,
just different places you were submitting it?
Yeah, we sent it in and it would bounce back at us. We sent it to biopolymers and it bounced back. And, and biopolymers is not exactly nature.
Yeah.
And then we submitted it to, we had it submitted twice to, with a lot of revisions to Biophysical Journal, where eventually it got published.
So why is it being rejected? I mean, what are you proposing to do that they're not seeing?
It's just nobody understood it. I mean, one of the problems, if you're ahead of your time, you have as much trouble as if you're behind your time.
If I
were to submit a paper now, saying that I think that the Watson Crick double helix, is without doubt. Has two parallel instead of anti-parallel strands, I'd be behind my time, I'd be stupid, and I'd be bounced. In the same token, if you're ahead of your time,
okay,
it's not the first time that happened to me. I'd already had that happen with Alex. The paper that was until about 6 months ago, my most highly cited paper.
Which one is this? This is your short list. Is it on there?
No, it's
okay.
Not. It's not in this, because this is a list of my own work. It starts in 82.
Okay.
Work that was associated with Alex. I would leave off that list. That it's a paper in PNAS that has about 900 and some odd sites. It's about the recognition of nucleic acids by proteins.
Okay.
Using hydrogen bonding. And basically, we just laid out the rules for it. And this was again, sort of my work. Alex did help on that somewhat, but in the sense that I wanted to push too hard on some certain things I saw. You're not really saying what you're really seeing there, that kind of thing. But we went back and forth on it. That one went back. That one was rejected by Journal of Molecular Biology. A lot of my stuff was rejected by Journal of Molecular Biology. I don't even want to send stuff there anymore. They're such a conservative, backward journal.
Okay.
I've sent them so much crap, so much good stuff over the years, stuff that's ultimately fairly heavily cited, and they just, you know.
So do people not see the biology? And I ask that because there was this recent article in Nature earlier this year.
In Science, actually.
Yeah, and it's, sorry, you're right,
in science, about what happened in science,
Yeah, where you get some review back, and
the guy says,
where's the biology?
Where's the biology?
Yeah.
And I said, well, there isn't any.
Okay.
This is chemistry, or it's, you know, it's whatever. And the editor, she just didn't get it.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, the story was the story. You know, that, you know, one guy, and I can only guess where's the biology editor was.
Hmm.
But but the other one, I know who he was,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he said, you know, this paper founds a new field,
mm-hmm.
and the other one said, you know, where's the biology? If it was who I think it was, we may have been somewhat competitors in other areas, and maybe he was just trying to, you know, to zap me.
Uh-huh.
But but that's just a guess as to who that was.
Yeah.
But, you know, the editor backed that one up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, well, where is the biology here? And I said, just because it's DNA doesn't mean it has to be biology.
That's something I wanted to ask you about,
sure.
and I had that for later on, but since you brought it up, let's just ask about it now. I mean, one of the things I find really interesting with the work that you and, you know, people like Paul Rodeman and drawing, I mean, the idea of just thinking about DNA is something you build with as opposed to thinking about it strictly as a biological molecule.
Right.
And
I mean, biology, we're exploiting an aspect of DNA that, to the best of our knowledge,
mm-hmm.
is not used by biology. That doesn't mean it isn't used by biology.
Mm-hmm.
It just means we don't know about it. I don't know about it. You know, except in relatively simplistic forms like in the Holliday Junk.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we're still very ignorant about what, you know, there's all this junk DNA. Could it be doing something?
Mm-hmm.
Could it be folding itself into interesting ways?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Could DNA and, you know, single-stranded, could DNA come apart and in the presence of various, you know, what's the word Paul uses? He's got scaffold strands and he's got staples.
Staples, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the presence of RNA staples, you know, could we be making structures? Could biology be making structures of one sort or another?
Mm-hmm.
Possibly ephemeral ones because, you know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not known yet. Probably won't be known in my lifetime definitively that it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Anything can be discovered at any time, of course.
Yeah.
I don't posit this kind of stuff. Let me take a bio break.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you the story as to how of the NIH's response to all of this.
Okay.
Or at least a guy at the
end. All right, I'm just going to pause this for a minute.
Okay. Wouldn't hurt after an hour and a half just to make sure it's working.
Yes. I don't want to check. All right, we're going to have about a 5-minute pause here.
Announces the National Nanotech Initiative.
Yeah, 2000.
About 2000.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'm on a study section.
Mm-hmm.
And
which section?
Sorry, this is NIH.
Okay.
And they've changed all the names.
Mm-hmm.
And my program manager says, at the NIH, says to me, you know, you're kind of nano-y. Why don't you help us organize this thing? Because a session at the Bethesda campus to set up. I didn't realize I still had my sabbatical message on there. I never listened to it. I mean, the messages send me an email always. Anyway, the NIH wanted to see how they should participate in nanotech and get their piece of the action and all that. So the upshot of this thing is a one-day session at in Bethesda, and there's like a plenary talk or two, 8 breakout sessions. We all come back. The breakout sessions address the rest of the group, maybe another plenary talk, end of day. The message from every one of the breakout sessions is NIH is not going to be a presence in nano until they get rid of the hypothesis-driven study section. So, which is how they evaluate. It's the study section how you evaluate grants.
Mm-hmm.
Hypothesis-driven means you can't say, well, we're going to try and make this because maybe it would be neat.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It means, hypothesis-driven means, We are exploring a biological problem, and we are going to test the following hypotheses to whatever. And at the end of this, up stands the head of the Inter-Institute Bioengineering whatever, and he says, oh, NIH understands that if they're going to do something with nano, it has to be done differently.
Mm-hmm.
About a year later, maybe 6 months, maybe 18 months, because it was in the wintertime, I'm the head of what's called a NIRT, Nanotech Interdisciplinary Research Team, and I have to go to NSF and do the dog and pony show for them. And I get up there, I give my talk about nanomotors and nanomachines, and I go back to the coffee machine to get a cup of coffee. And there's this head of the interdisciplinary, you know, whatever. And I say, hey, how you doing?
Mm-hmm.
He says, fine. You know, Ned, you propose that stuff to the NIH, you'll never get funded. I told him, listen, I'm not stupid. I never propose this kind of stuff to the NIH.
Yeah.
No way.
Mm-hmm. You know?
So that's sort of, you know.
So what kinds of stuff do you propose to the NIH versus?
Well characterization of branch, for many years it was characterization of branch, you know, molecular biophysics of branch DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming out of all this, there is a structure that we sort of derived in a kind of backhanded way from the nanotech. And we realized that in fact it might act as a way in which double helical DNA can recognize homologous sequences of double helical DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And we have data that supports that notion.
Mm-hmm.
We published a paper to that effect last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing more experiments on that now. That doesn't mean that it does happen that way, but it happens in supercoiled DNA. It doesn't happen if your DNA is not supercoiled. I mean, basically, we've discovered there are a number of these different motifs that DNA can assume to relax the stress of supercoiling as a function of sequence. So we talked about cruciforms and extruding a cruciform in the case of a palindrome.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, do you know what zDNA is?
B is either the right-hand spiral, Z is the left-hand spiral.
You're right. So that if you have a supercoiled molecule, you can relax the stress on that if you have the right sequence, typically CG, 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 although others are okay. You can make left-handed DNA, and then that'll relax the fact that you're, you know, basically underlinked because you're changing the character of the DNA. There are there are other things that DNA can do to relax it as a function of sequence, and homology is one of those.
Okay.
So for what that's worth.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the funding. So, I mean, if you sort of look at the funding that you received over the last 25 or 30 years, what percent is NIH, defense, NSF? How would you break it down?
NIH was all of it until 89.
Okay.
In 89, I received a small amount of Navy funding. Mm-hmm. That stayed relatively small. But it was, so I was basically one-third Navy, two-thirds NIH, till the end of the 90s. Mm-hmm. Then the Air Force chimed in for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Then the Navy dropped me. I had a huge amount of DARPA money for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. That they then sent to Iraq. Mm-hmm. I've had... NSF has been a relatively minor contributor to my work, except for, well, the NERT is like 100 a year. I mean, we're not talking about a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 100 a year when I had the NERT. Maybe it was 120, mm-hmm. of that order. And I also have NSF funding for DNA-based computation.
Okay.
So each of them was, you know, smallish amounts of money. Mm-hmm. So the NSF, and then the military... has been, in recent years, the military is actually more than the NIH.
Okay.
Part of that is just self-defense, mm-hmm. no pun intended here, that if I have one NIH grant and the mm-hmm. NIH has become very much more iffy, mm-hmm. I've never been zapped by the NIH, but I'm a little scared of it. Mm-hmm. As everybody is, so I'm sort of building up my defense money, in case the NIH does zap me when I go in for a renewal next year.
So the defense projects that you're doing, I mean, what do they want to get out of it?
They sort of tilt towards nanoelectronics.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought,
smaller, faster computation.
Sure.
And so forth.
So the DNA nanocomputing would be attractive to them.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, not so much DNA computing, mm-hmm. using DNA to organize, you know, nanoscale components.
Okay.
All right. That's different from, you know, the kind of DNA-based computation that whole community.
Like Winfrey and Adelman and those.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's totally different.
Okay. Thanks.
That's more interesting material.
Okay. But that's a much more computation-oriented one, where you're talking more about a physical approach to building.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, both. You know, everybody who participates in one, pretty much everybody who participates in one. Mm-hmm. Well, so many of the people who experimentally participate in one experimentally participate in the other.
Okay. So let's go back a bit to the Escher and the 82 image, and I guess I sort of want to walk forward to that, to when you come to NYU. So you have your, I'm going to call your Escher epiphany, and you have the Nucleic Junctions paper coming out. So what's your next, you know, 4 or 5 years spent developing?
Okay, so next 4 or 5 years is spent, you know, learning how to work with DNA in solution.
Okay.
Trying to keep the NIH happy enough with my, with my results. Mm-hmm. So it was in 83 that we published the first branch junction, that we'd made it, you know, from synthetic oligos. Then, in a slightly different thrust, in the thrust involving this work, Bruce Robinson and I, you know, not related to our previous work, we just ran into each other at a biophysics meeting, and he said, I'm making some kind of biochip, and I said, gee, I've been thinking about that. And so in early 85, I went out and visited Bruce in Washington. We worked together for about a week and put together something.
University of Washington?
Yeah, University of Washington. He's been on the faculty there since 80.
Okay.
And maybe 81, I mentioned, but 80, I think. And he and I put together a paper. I don't know if you've seen it or not.
I read it this morning. I read the introduction.
Okay.
And I was curious about it. I mean, I think the paper came out in 87.
Yeah, it was. We tried to get into PNAS, and some asshole said no.
Okay.
And then we didn't know you couldn't resubmit it to a different member, so it took till 87 to get it out in protein engineering.
But there was a lot of talk in the early 80s through the mid 80s, I mean, people like Forrest Carter and maybe even Kevin Ulmer a little bit, talking about molecular electronics. Was your That's work right. kind of part of that whole?
I think so. Except you know they were doing they were thinking in terms of proteins and you know there's no control from proteins.
Okay.
Everything you know DNA has structural information.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can use the information in DNA to direct structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe someday, obviously, we'll be able to do that with proteins. But I mean, I don't plan to wait till I'm 127 to try to do that. You
know? Okay. So tell me about the biochip work then. I mean, what?
So we just, you know, I mean, it was very straightforward. You know, in the sense that we didn't, you know, we knew nothing at that time about the structure of any of the components we were proposing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Bruce had done some work about. Getting about using polyacetylene, I guess,
mm-hmm.
As a potential molecular wire.
Okay.
He didn't know whether then, and I don't know whether now, I mean, maybe he knows now, whether whatever transport happens there happens along the molecule or in the interstices between molecules.
Okay.
I mean, he only knew, you know, because he had a macroscopic,
mm-hmm.
At least not a single molecule thing there over which he was sending or through which he was sending whatever he was sending, and I think it was mostly I think it was electrons that may have been spins, I don't know.
Hmm.
And I just organized a you know a DNA lattice that would accommodate it.
Okay.
The small
did you go to any of Forrest Carter's
no,
Moltronics?
I was you know an unknown in those days. I wasn't invited to anything.
Hmm.
Okay. Of importance. I mean, yeah, I remember there was a kind of major book, a major meeting review or something like that came out about 84, 85, I was, you know, about unusual conformations of DNA, and I wasn't invited, and fuck them very much.
So the work you're doing with Bruce, I mean, I guess...
So that was theoretical, that was sort of the last
thing. So this was just imagining what you could possibly do?
Well, it was sort of a blueprint for how to do it.
Okay.
You know, and other people have told me that was the first thing that they'd read that didn't seem to be total bullshit.
Uh-huh.
Whether it was or it wasn't, you know, I mean, in the end, you know, obviously we would do things differently today. We know things today we didn't know then.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the basics as to how we're thinking about and approaching nanoelectronics doesn't differ very much from what was in that paper.
Okay. I mean, Forrest Carter always struck me as just sort of an interesting, charismatic figure that, you know...
Yeah, I never met him.
Okay.
He died relatively young.
He died like 86, 87, somewhere.
Yeah, but I mean, he died relatively soon after that got going.
Okay.
I never met Ulmer either.
I've talked to him on the phone. I haven't met him, so...
And, but, you know, I mean, all these people talked. They didn't actually do anything.
Yeah, and it was heavily protein and
it was all protein and
organic polymer oriented, I guess.
Well, I mean, you have to use organic polymers if you're going to get any kind of conduction. I mean, I don't know whether the transmission of electrons or photons or any other damn thing through DNA is ever going to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I'm one of the grants in which I'm involved now is exploring some of the features of that.
Okay.
But I am not going to, you know, bet the farm on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we're looking for, you know, so our idea is you use the architectural properties of DNA to organize things whose electronic and other properties are appropriate for the task.
Okay. So I had a question. You know, in doing background research to prepare for this interview, I think Paul actually told me to look at George Church's webpage where he has some lab notebooks from 1977 where he's talking about DNA lattices.
Yeah,
and Paul said to ask you what's the connection between what...
Okay,
you know.
I presented an early version of that 82 paper at an 81 Gordon conference.
What was the... With the
nucleic
theme
acid.
Of it.
Nucleic acids, Gordon conference.
Okay.
And Sung Ho Kim, whom I mentioned earlier, was there. George worked for Sung Ho.
Hmm.
And Sung Ho said, "You should talk to George Church. He's got the same idea."
Hmm.
So I gave George a call,
mm-hmm.
and he got back to me. And we had a few chit-chats back and forth. And I continued to pursue it. And George had other fish to fry.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get any ideas from George.
Mm-hmm.
The one time I suggested something to him, he said he didn't think that was a very good idea. And that was my only contact with George in this regard. I mean, I've obviously run into George over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, if George had chosen in 19, whatever it was, 77, to pursue that, well, he did spend his life in what I can euphemistically call middle-level institutions.
Mm-hmm.
He'd have got wherever I've got, wherever I got till 2000 at any rate,
mm-hmm.
because now there are people in good institutions doing it, one hell of a lot faster than I would have.
Hmm.
And he would have just, swamped me.
Hmm.
But George didn't pursue it, and I did.
Okay.
It's that simple. I mean, and again, I didn't know very much about what George was doing, and... You know, maybe I'm just incompetent, and it took me 29 years to get that crystal. And it is the great crystal, and we're still looking to make better crystals and so forth. But the only thing I can say is, certainly in the 4,000, well, it wasn't 4,000 days, it was only about 3,000 days since I had the idea
mm-hmm.
at Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the succeeding, say, 11 years till 2000,
mm-hmm.
I had to sweat everything out and bootleg everything up off of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if George ever got funded for this or not. I never saw any applications from him.
Yeah.
And, you know, if George didn't have a web page, nobody would know about it at all because he never published it.
Yeah, I only know about it because, in talking to Paul down at Caltech, he said, take a look at George's webpage.
Yeah, George has one. And I've looked at the webpage, too. It's kind of primitive, and it's old, and he's, I mean, I was...
It's just a JPEG of a lab notebook, so...
So what? I went to a meeting. It was a symposium in honor of Govind Khurana.
Hmm.
You know who?
Yeah, he just passed away.
He just died.
Yeah.
And this was in the summer, I think, of 2000. And it may have been 9, it may have been 10. And George was also an invited speaker there. And George gets up there and he talks about how, well, he did the structure of tRNA, but you're hearing about that from Tom Rajbandari or Aki Ullenbeck or whoever else was there.
Hello.
So he was a spear carrier. If I say I was a spear carrier on tRNA, he carried the spear for a spear carrier on tRNA.
Okay.
He did absolutely nothing
uh-huh.
on tRNA. I mean, he was the undergraduate in Sung Ho's lab at Duke. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So he's... And then he flashes up his webpage, this JPEG.
Mm-hmm.
So he says... So you'll hear about, tRNA from whoever else is here. You've heard about it already from them.
Mm-hmm.
And tRNA structure from them. And then you've heard about... And you're going to hear about, DNA nanotech from Ned Seaman. So I'm going to talk to you about... DNA nanotech that I, originally proposed, you're going to hear about how Ned picked up on that or anything, whatever. so George probably, my guess is George probably regrets that he didn't push that play as hard as he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, George went from Sung Ho as an undergraduate to Wally Gilbert as a graduate student to some, I guess, more or less permanent position at Harvard Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
And... if he wanted to push that, it was his right,
mm-hmm.
and it was his privilege, and he certainly would have been able to obtain the resources.
Mm-hmm.
I had to bootleg it
mm-hmm.
for years and years and years,
mm-hmm.
and if in the end, I didn't have many options. Either
mm-hmm.
I was going to be a failed crystallographer,
mm-hmm.
or I was going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to do some other experiments for the NIH on branched DNA.
Mm-hmm.
I never really knew what was going to come out to be most important.
Mm-hmm.
And then, from 2000 on, I'm still in a middle-level institution, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
In recent years, they're trying to make this slightly better, but it's still a middle-level institution. You know, where NYU is not Harvard, it's not MIT, it's not Caltech, it's not Stanford, or Berkeley, or any of the others. But those, some of those places, Caltech and Harvard in particular, are now hiring young people to do this. I mean, I'm too old for any of this. I, the last time I tested the waters several years ago, they told me I was too old. So it goes. I mean, I'm perfectly happy living in New York for the rest of my life. You know, so powerful institutions are now in this field that I certainly originated experimentally. If, you know, if George had an earlier idea,
so be it.
So be it. Yeah, I mean, you know, good ideas are a dime a dozen. You, you know, if you don't follow, if you don't pursue them, and it takes a certain amount of cojones, to be honest, to pursue them.
So tell me, okay, before I sort of move you forward in time to when you come to NYU, do you want to say more about the bootstrapping that you were doing while you were still in Albania?
Well, you know, during that time, we didn't publish an awful lot on this stuff. Much more of it was on the just the biophysics of branched DNA. We made a... We did a ligation experiment on a three-arm branch junction.
Okay.
I'm not sure ligation experiments are really great experiments for branch junctions.
Why?
Because, I mean, our conclusion was that the branch junctions were, the three-arm branch junction was flexible. But, you know, there was some ATP involved there, and that may be distorting the essence of the system. A simple branch, three-arm branch junction probably is somewhat floppy. That was our conclusion. We made a square that was sort of published by the time we got to NYU, around the time we got to NYU.
This is the cube paper with
the... No, the square.
Square, okay.
So that's not listed as one of the major things. And then we were involved a lot in sort of working out the structure of the Holliday junction solution. There was a collaboration there with Tom Tullius. We had a couple of papers with him using his hydroxyl radical attack method. And we kind of made a variation on the theme. He was doing hydroxyl radical footprinting. So a footprint is you have a piece of DNA and you want to know where a protein binds. So you bind the protein to it and you throw... Hydroxyl radicals are probably the best way to do it. You put... iron complex with EDTA in there, and it generates hydrogen peroxide, and that in turn generates hydroxyl radicals. And you put in there with the it generates hydroxyl radicals from peroxide that's in there, and then that attacks the DNA, and you can see where is it broken and where is it not broken.
So it sort of eats it away and leaves the...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's single-hit kinetics, right? So,
okay.
You know, so it cuts here, and you've got a label up here. So you run around on a gel, and you say, okay, we cut here. So this is a fragment this long. That's that position, right? And then there's that position. But in this position, so where my wristwatch is, well, it couldn't attack because it's protected there, right? And then here, so that's a straight-up footprint. So we made a variation on that theme, sort of auto-footprint, where you take... a motif like the Holliday junction, and you hit it with hydroxyl radicals, and then you take each of those same strands and you put them up against their Watson-Crick complement, and you see what's different.
Okay.
And so that was what we did in that era. We also were, so we showed that it was the bases next to the Holliday junction determined. Well, first we showed that it's not that sort of intersection, but in fact that you have two domains, and secondly, we show that it's the bases flanking the domain that actually affect whether it's going to be arm 1 stacked on arm 2, arm 3 stacked on arm 4, or 1 stacked on 4 and 2 stacked on 3.
Okay.
There are two possibilities there. And we also showed that for one of the enzymes, what it cuts either the crossover strands or the non-crossover strands in that structure. And then we left Albany.
Okay. Before you leave Albany, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that was interesting to me about reading, looking through your biochip paper this morning, was you and Bruce cited Drexler's 81 PNAS paper.
Yeah.
And I know in his work following, you are one of the few scientists that he's consistently cited through his work. Yeah. And I was just kind of curious about the interactions.
I first met Eric in 89.
Okay.
I was newly at NYU. It was like February.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the biophysics meeting in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. Hello? That was an offer I couldn't.
I understand.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Okay.
You were at a biophysics meeting, 89.
Yes, and there was some nano group. You know, nanotech oscillated back and forth for a while after Eric wrote his book,
mm-hmm.
between sort of science and sort of cult.
Yeah, you and I emailed a little bit about this, which was really helpful for me.
Okay.
But and I know I'm kind of going over ground that you and I have gone over, but the people reading this 10 years from now won't know.
Honest to goodness, I don't necessarily remember everything. I have it on here, but I don't remember everything.
Fair enough.
Because I've written many of these same things to many other people.
I understand.
Okay. So it was partly cult and partly science.
Mm-hmm.
So from the biophysics meeting, I flew to Washington to Seattle.
This was the NanoCon meeting that they were having.
Yeah, in Seattle.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't remember how much I told you about that meeting.
Not much.
Okay. So that was where I met Eric for the first time. And what it was is, you know, since Bruce is in Seattle and he knew about this, he and I were invited to talk about the biochip paper, basically.
Okay.
And Eric Drexler talked about, you know, Eric Drexlerism, or whatever, you know, nanotech as he saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've never heard Eric say anything that I knew was wrong or stupid. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that, you know, one of the things he does do, of course, is take credit for anything that happens and say, well, that's sort of what we predicted. You know, he's a little on the Gene Dixon-esque side. Am I going back too far for you?
No, I know who Gene Dixon is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't even know if she still is. But,
She may have moved on to a higher plane. But
yeah, yes. But, yeah. I mean, you know, but the point is, he and the other, Foresight people.
Yeah.
We're sort of willing to take credit for anything that happened that was sort of, there will be a great tidal wave and deaths that happen, and then, you know, sometime in the 2000s, and sure enough, there's a tsunami in South India and there's Katrina, you know, and well, gee, you know, what was the probability that would happen in that decade?
Yeah.
You know, it's a little of that there, but I've never heard, Eric himself doesn't tend to do much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who kind of followed Eric tended to. Anyway, so that was the first time I met him. And I went to this... Did I tell you about this party I went to? Yeah, okay, so between the first and the second day of this thing, there's a party at one of the organizers' houses, and I'm there, and I'm talking up some young thing there. And she says, gee, isn't it a pity that we're the last generation to die? And I say, huh? And she says, yeah, well, I mean, you know, once nanotech comes, we'll all be able to live forever. And I said, oh, isn't that interesting? Excuse me, I need another beer. And, you know, and
so that would be the cultish.
That was sort of the cultish aspect of it. And then the following morning, the first morning is Eric talks for about an hour and a half. Bruce and I talk for maybe a total of an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of the scientists. That afternoon, the next day, is a combination of software people and science fiction writers.
Okay.
Some of whom were very well-known
yeah.
science fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gregory Benham, Benham, whatever his first name.
Benford.
Benford. Benford.
Yeah, yeah.
Greg Benford, Bear.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, well-known people.
Yeah.
And The Last Morning,
mm-hmm.
it's a sort of a wrap-up. And Eric himself saying, you know, cut out the bullshit,
mm-hmm.
right? That, you know, he doesn't want all of this stuff to be, you know, a cult. He wants it to be, you know, something that's going to be pursued technologically.
Yeah.
You know, even if he's not going to do it. I mean, you know, he has all this, he published his paper after, or at least book after book. I've never seen any papers since that first PNAS.
Yeah.
On, I looked for them. On, you know, on his stuff. But it's all theoretical stuff of, you know, well, you know, if, you know, if we had this, we could do that. If we had this, we could do that. Mm-hmm. It's you know, there's, all of us draw the line between speculation and extrapolation in different places.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I probably don't draw it in the same place.
Okay.
But, mm-hmm. yeah, but that's okay. We all have our personal choices. And then at the very end, somebody, you know, there are only about 40, 50 people at this meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's taking place in some, you know, moderate-sized room in a hotel somewhere.
Yeah.
And in the end, somebody says, well, you know, everybody who was invited has had their chance to talk. Does anybody else want to get up and say something? And one guy stands up and says, well, mine is the first entire family in the state of Washington to arrange to have ourselves frozen. Does anybody want my phone number? And all these notebooks come out, people start scribbling down.
Yeah, because Nano had a lot of early interest from the cryonics community.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
Which is weird. I mean, it's you have that, but you also had a lot of early interest from the computer science and computer programming
right.
people.
Yeah, well, see,
yeah.
all of that was a problem in many regards.
The cryonics or the computer science?
The computer science. Hmm. Because, you know, with the exception of certain computability issues, which mm-hmm. we can forget about, you know, if you ask me to write a program to do X, Y, Z, I can do it. It may be clunky, it may be a shitty piece of code, it may not work, do what you want done nearly as well as you would like it done,
mm-hmm.
but no matter what, I can write a program to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That is the perspective of software people.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the perspective of a laboratory scientist. Sometimes you just get into the lab
mm-hmm.
and damn it, it should all work and it doesn't, damn it, you know?
Huh.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. You know, every time I think I know what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
and I either try, well, I mean, these days I don't do anything with my own paws anymore, but, you know, so I give it to a student, or but whatever, you know, there's a reasonably small chance,
mm-hmm.
even on guaranteed stuff,
mm-hmm.
that it's actually going to work out the way I expect it to.
Okay.
All right? And often things just don't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's the difference between somebody who does experiments
mm-hmm.
and somebody who writes code.
Hmm.
Not everything works. Now, there may be reasons why it doesn't work. You know, good scientists try to figure out why it didn't work,
mm-hmm.
or either... so that they can get it to work, or so that they can learn some new principle,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And, of course, we do that, too.
Yeah.
But that I think you'll find that a laboratory scientist, and I'll include, you know, theoretical, you know, mm-hmm. hardcore scientists in that group, people who work closely with experimentalists,
mm-hmm.
Probably draw that line between extrapolation and speculation a little closer to the experiment
mm-hmm.
than do, say, software people
hmm.
or others of that sort.
So do you think that accounts for some of the animosity that chemists had for Drexler's ideas versus the, you know, the fact that the computer science people seem to be more willing to go with it?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, I never had any problem with any of Eric's suggestions
mm-hmm.
about things to do.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my better known work is, in fact, stuff that was, you know, that originated with Eric,
mm-hmm.
but which, you know, we didn't do on the you know, with carbon and whatever,
yeah.
But did in fact with on the nano scale rather than the angstrom scale, with nucleic acids. A year ago we published this the assembly line, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
which is really kind of interesting to read about because it seemed in some ways
it was certainly inspired by some of the stuff that Eric talked about.
Okay, I mean that's a fair question then. I mean, and that was actually my next question, which was, would you see his work as having any influence, or his ideas as having any influence on your own work?
In the sense of you know what can be made, yes.
Okay.
Now, or you know, on the scale that we work, you know, when I started off, I was kind of embarrassed to be working on the quote nanoscale, where because all the, you know, like the organic chemists in this department, they work on the angstrom scale, right?
Sure.
You know, a bond is an angstrom and a half, right? Plus or minus an inorganic compound. And, you know, my fundamental width is the width of DNA, nanometers.
Couple nanometers, yeah.
And, you know, the repeat's 3.5. Mm-hmm. I don't have to go a full repeat to do things, but, you know, we're basically, you know, our basic quantized unit is of the order of, you know, a few nanometers, and it's basically 10 times as large as the others.
Yeah.
And I was really pleased when nano came along because suddenly I would, you know, nano was in fact my domain.
Huh. Okay. So finally you had a name for what you were doing?
Yeah, after a fashion.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, there are a lot of people who do things with DNA.
Yeah.
That I don't call structural DNA nanotech. Okay, I mean, I've been calling what we do structural DNA nanotech. The name's kind of been usurped a bit by the origami people, but and you know, for me, origami is one of many techniques that you know we use it when we need it. But we do lots of things that don't have to do with origami, and or would that involve origami, but that's not the key feature. The essence of what we do is that the structure, and when I say structure, I mean 3D structure, of the DNA or the construct, whatever it's going to be, is central, or at least the topology, is central to the nature of what it is we're constructing. So, for instance, the kind of stuff where you take, say, a nanoparticle and put a lot of DNA on it, and then you take another nanoparticle with complementary or whatever DNA on, you throw them together and you get some kind of schmutz. That's not what I call structural DNA nanotech. It's certainly DNA based nanotech, you know, in one sort or another. But I mean, for us, it's that wouldn't really fall into the purview of what we do. So when I talk about 50 or 60 labs doing what we do, maybe more than 60 now.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people who are actually, you know, care about the fact that you know, these two helices are one next to the other, and there's a third one over here, or maybe there's a, you know, an arrangement, or, you know, sort of things that my students have done.
Yeah.
With, you know, Hao Yan's faces and you know, Cheng De Mao's star.
Yeah.
Eager and so forth.
So I mean, if you have to give the elevator description of what structural DNA is, structural DNA nanotechnology is, What do you say?
I say it's using the chemical information in DNA to control the three-dimensional structure of objects, lattices, and nanoscale devices.
Okay.
Nanomechanical devices.
Yeah. That's certainly an elevator
description.
Okay. So the move to NYU.
Okay, so that...
How's that happen?
What?
How did that happen?
It happened because Neville Kallenbach became chair here.
Okay.
And... So he and I had been working together for a long time, and he brought me in, to be a guy he could talk to, and a guy, you know, who was doing stuff similar to what he was doing, and so forth.
What was the state of the chemistry department like when you showed up here?
Well, Neville was improving it.
Yeah.
From what it had been.
Okay.
Enormously, but then he had, you know, something happened, and then it didn't. They stopped giving money. So what happened was, he brought, including himself, he brought in four relatively senior PIs. Not necessarily. Well, three were senior. One was just very strong. He was junior, but he'd already been nominated for Nobel Prize. Okay.
Who's this?
David Schwartz. I don't know if you know the name.
Name's familiar, I can't.
Okay. You may have heard of Schwartz and Kanner post-filled gel electrophoresis. It was a really big deal in the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
I don't think it's a big deal anymore.
Okay.
All right. It was a major technique then, and Schwartz was an extremely bright guy.
Okay.
Anyway, so the 11th, the 10th, which is where I normally live, the 9th floor and this 8th floor were given respectively, were you know, designated for Kallenbach. Schwartz was on 8, I was on 10, and 9 was a guy named Joel Friedman who came from Bell. So Joel's a guy, you know, roughly my age, a couple years younger. And, you know, for Schwartz, they wrote a huge grant to set up his lab.
Mm-hmm.
For me, they gave me kind of minimal because I knew I'd have to pay them to get my ass out of Albany. And for Friedman, they gave away the store.
What was his work?
Friedman was a spectroscopist, one flavor or another. And he came from Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a pretty bright guy, but he had no academic background at all.
Hmm.
I mean, yes, he got his PhD and an MD, in fact.
Yeah.
But
he was used to working with the Bell system.
He was used to working with the Bell system, and he didn't understand how to operate the university in any regard.
Hmm.
So he got this huge setup.
Mm-hmm.
He spent it all on toys rather than on postdocs so that he could get the data to get the grants.
Mm-hmm.
So he got one small grant. He was given a kingly salary, as Neville described it. I never found out how much it was.
Mm.
But, you know, part of that kingly salary was assumed he was going to get a, you know, a full-size summer salary, which he wasn't able to drag down at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is 1990, I guess he came.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him $600,000, which in those days was a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, today you can't get an average assistant professor for that. We're going back almost 25 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, from when negotiations started, I mean, I got like 200, you know, and was damn glad to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And after 1 year, I mean, Friedman had no idea how to operate, so he didn't get the preliminary data for his grants.
Mm-hmm.
He picked up whatever garbage was floating around the department for his graduate students. I mean, he didn't get anybody any good. He spent all of his time being a Renaissance thinker at home in South Orange, which is across the river. So he was almost never here. And then he teaches one quarter of the freshman course in which he sort of quizzes our pre-meds about things having to do with some of the fundamental paradoxes of quantum mechanics. And these kids don't get A's. They don't get to medical school. They don't get to medical school. They don't stay at NYU.
Yeah.
You know, because NYU charges just like anybody else, any better school. And he was giving them grades according to their understanding, you know, which you can't do. I mean, you know, all right, you know, the kids all fuck up the exam, all right. So you say a 30 is an A and a 10 is a B.
Yeah.
You know, you do what you got to do to keep these pre-meds happy. They're the fucking customers.
Mm-hmm.
So he did everything wrong, and then in the fall of 1991, I could be off a year here, but I think I'm better right. He goes up to Einstein.
The medical.
Yeah.
Huh.
Where they made him a chair, so he had a guaranteed 12-month salary. Everybody else is 6 months, but the chair is 12 months. And so he didn't have to worry about getting his big salary. And they gave him even more toy money. They made him a chair, so they gave him more money to bring in colleagues. And I don't know how well he's done as chairman there. He's no longer the chair, I believe. But, you know, it doesn't matter one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Neville lost all the confidence of the higher-ups when that happened. I mean, nobody was really all that sorry to see Friedman go because he really didn't know what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But from the point of view of those of us, you know, in the trenches, but from the point of view of those who had just paid $600,000 and they'd given another $400,000 guarantee, but that was like against the grant that actually did come in.
Yeah.
But, you know, they just saw it as, you know, here's a mega buck and we're not, you know, and we just lost it, basically.
So for you personally, I mean, I know, you know, it's abundantly clear that Albany did not suit you. But, I mean, what did it mean just professionally to come here? I mean, what did it...
It meant I had a labor force.
Okay.
I mean, that was what I did not have in Albany.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was in Albany, I was somewhat friendly with... Every department has a sort of curator, manager, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a good guy up there. He had, like, a master's in bio. Mm-hmm. And, he was the guy that, you know, used to call him the department proctologist. You had a pain in the ass to saw him. Right?
Okay.
And also, one time he got really pissed off at the chair, who was complaining about the administrators in a, including himself, in a in some generally broadcast memo that he really mm-hmm. had no right to do, but he was kind of, Lerman was Lerman. And anyway, so... And he complained to me about it. He said, doesn't this guy understand, you know, we read books about what we do, too. We try to improve ourselves just like you guys read your journals.
Mm.
You know, so one day I went up to him and I said, you know, these undergraduates don't work out for me. Can you give me one or two of these books of yours about, you know, management?
Hmm.
He said, sure. And he said, let me, you know, I read them. And, you know, there was 400 pages there and it wasn't, you know, But you could boil it down to one key principle that I didn't have working for me there, which is that if somebody works for you, their tomorrow has to depend on their today with you. You know, if they're going off to medical school, doesn't matter what they do in your laboratory, then they're no use to you, right? I mean, that was the breakdown, you know. People will not do anything for you unless they're going to get something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more than just my recommendation letter to, yes, this kid worked in my lab, right? Which is why nobody was ever doing anything for me. And I understood that principle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they weren't graduate students. For a graduate student, what they do in the lab today is going to affect where they go tomorrow and what their whole future is going to be, because that's where they're going. They're going into science. They're not going into medicine. And, I mean, they're going into science somewhat influenced by what they're doing with me, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't have that in Albany, and I did have it here.
Okay.
I mean, I got here, I mean, I had a total of 6 student years of labor in Albany, including 1 bozo year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Here, within the first year, I had that every year. Now I have about, you know, nearly double that.
Okay.
All right? And, you know, science is... It's not a matter of monkeys and typewriters, because the people running the typewriters have to have some sense of grammar, if you know what I mean, and some sense of spelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, typewriters are not word processors. But they nevertheless, so they have to have brains, but you just need enough people to try enough things.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do that before. So nothing much happened in Albany.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had the idea. I fumfered along a little bit, you know, basically living off of my collaboration with Neville.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Okay.
And, you know, end of what I could do in Albany. I mean, I had more ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I had plenty more ideas when I was up there, some of which I'm still executing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of which I executed over the course of my first, you know, decade or so here.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I still have ideas. I'm still executing ideas.
Yeah.
But it was all just based on, it was all ideas up there. There was no output to speak of, except the last couple of years when I had my, you know, the guy who became my first PhD student. Well, I had it was my last 4 years. I had this one master student for 1 year, another master student for 2 years. This is the guy who became my first PhD student.
Mm-hmm.
And then my PhD student from there who spent 2 years with me there and came here. Going. And that was all I had for labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything that got done was mostly done in Neville's lab by his technician.
Hmm.
And that was the story.
Could you tell me how you manage and organize your lab? I mean, I guess we could start with, you know, how you did it in 1990 versus how you do it now, but I mean...
It's not much different.
Okay, so how did you...
Except that I'm not in the lab anymore, I'm not here all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I know you travel a lot. So.
I travel a lot.
Yeah.
So, okay, so the 90s were somewhat different from the aughts.
Okay.
Okay, so in the 90s, you know, I mean, I was doing the DNA synthesis myself.
Okay.
All right, that meant I was in the lab about an hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that. Now, usually that wasn't an hour when there were too many other people here, but I was available. I mean, I you know, in my real office, I mean, you know, you can see in. I mean, my door is always open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the place was open for my students to come in anytime. Mm-hmm. As the years have gone by, you know, it's there. You know, fewer. Though my students then were maybe in their middle and late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of them got caught up in the Cultural Revolution and so forth.
Mm.
Virtually all my students, not quite all, but virtually all my students are from the PRC.
I want to ask that. You about that, but I want to come back to that.
Okay.
But yeah.
Well, so they were like, and, you know, and I was sort of 40-ish, and I wasn't, you know, really old.
Yeah.
You know, now, of course, they're 22, 23, 24. I'm more than 40 years older.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's a little harder, you know. I'm not buddies with them anymore. I don't, you know, we don't go out drinking together or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If I go out drinking, I go out drinking with faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they don't come in to see me anymore very often. From the next room, they'll send me an email.
Huh.
You know, so that's changed.
Mm-hmm.
Now the big change that happened in the lab, or a major change that happened in the lab, was toward the end of the 90s when my profile really went up.
Yeah.
Right? End of the 90s, beginning of this last decade. And I started traveling three times as much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that coincided, and I started getting more money.
Mm-hmm.
That coincided with the dot-com boom.
Mm-hmm.
So I had so the way it works in my lab, where we've been in my lab, and since the largest sense still does, the older students teach the younger students,
sure.
The younger students become older students.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 90s, a whole bunch of kids came in and said, well, you know, I really want to take this course on systems programming.
Hmm.
And I said to them, you know, not being stupid, you know, you want to go into computer science, see them. Right? And I said, listen, you want to take that course or you want to stay in this lab?
Mm.
You know, I mean, one or two I might have let do it, but I mean, I realized, but they were leaving anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So they all left. So, not quite all, but I had a kind of hiatus there.
Hmm.
And at the same time, I got some money, so I brought in some postdocs who really didn't know anything, you know, right? Because I couldn't. There were no postdocs who knew anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's for as a rule, I don't bring in a postdoc anymore unless they come on their own money.
Hmm.
All my money goes to students, and a postdoc can get their own money, but I can't.
Mm-hmm.
A student can't quite the same way. Postdocs didn't know anything, and I was on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I divide science up into to the one-minute version of how I see running in science.
Okay.
Right? The three levels. It's the technical, the tactical, and the strategic.
Hmm.
Technical level is, you know, how do you run a gel, how do you use an instrument without breaking the instrument, without blowing up the laboratory, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The other end is the strategic level. What projects are we going to pursue?
Mm-hmm.
What programs are we going to pursue?
Mm-hmm.
What is this lab all about? So the first is the business of the postdocs and the students.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally hopeless with anything in the lab. I don't even, you know, there was a time when the first version of, you know, like the synthesizer,
mm-hmm.
you know, I didn't actually take that one apart, but I took apart everything else.
Mm-hmm.
Second version, I don't even know how to turn it on.
Hmm.
All right. On the other hand, it's my job to do the strategy.
Okay. Right?
I write the grants.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the guy who has to beg the money. I know what has to be done to keep the money.
Mm-hmm.
All right? In between is the tactical level,
mm-hmm.
which is basically what we teach a graduate student. How do you do research? You can't teach somebody what program to do. They can only guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only guess. But I can teach them how to do research. I can teach them how to design an experiment,
mm-hmm.
how to debug an experiment, troubleshoot an experiment, how to... worry about controls and how to, you know, put together data in such a form that ultimately it will be publishable material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to think about, you know, the things you can be doing wrong. Okay. Nobody in the lab could troubleshoot an experiment, during that period when there were these three more or less ignorant postdocs, and the senior graduate students had gone. The upshot of that was everything was going to hell. So what I did was I brought back one of my former very good students as laboratory manager, and he's still with me.
Who's this?
Ruchi Shah.
Ruchi Shah?
Okay. Yeah, S-H-A. And you know, you see his name on a lot of my papers. Mm-hmm. And right now, you know, the lab is very dependent on I'm very dependent on Ruchi because he's well paid. He's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. But he's, you know, basically, he provides all the knowledge in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it took a few years to get the kids to understand that they should go to Ruchi if they want to know how to do something.
Okay.
But now they understand.
So when you're training graduate students, do you give them all a shared set of problems and techniques that they have to master?
We have a few trainer exercises.
That's kind of what I mean. Yeah.
We have a trainer exercise, but every student has his or her own problem.
Yeah, that okay? I understand.
I don't want any competition in the lab. I want cooperation. You know? If somebody needs to know how to do something and they don't know how to do it, it's too hard for them, and this person knows how to do it, fine. They can be an author on the paper and then just do that thing. I've done that a fair amount. But no, I don't like competition in the lab. I think that's kind of nasty. I've known people who've done that.
Yeah.
And I've not thought highly of them.
Okay.
Despite their Nobel Prizes.
Okay. Okay. But I guess where I was going more is, you know, say it's your first, you know, your first semester here as a graduate student. You know, by the end of the semester, you know, is there a, you know, set of research protocols where they should have learned how to use X, Y, and Z pieces of
equipment? Yeah.
Can you sort of like walk me through what that's?
The three exercises that they do, they only have a month because we have a rotation system, right? The rotations used to be longer. You know, rotation is to choosing an advisor, like dating is to choosing a spouse. Right?
Okay.
You know, so you know.
So they don't come in here already working with you?
No. Many of them may come in wanting to work with me, but then we get to look at each other, right?
Oh, okay.
And okay. So then there's, so that they, we have four training exercises. We don't do very much of what they learned in the second one anymore. So I'll give you all. The first one is, we give them a forearm, the strands for a forearm junction. You know, like they have to purify the strands. They have to learn how to work out the stoichiometry so that they can get a single band on a gel, which means they have to learn how to run the gel without any crap below it. Which means they have to get the stoichiometry sort of 1:1:1:1. Which isn't so easy.
Of the strands?
Of the four strands that they put together in the pot and run it on a gel and show that. So that's experiment one. So they learn how to do gel electrophoresis, and native gel electrophoresis, and you know, not non-denaturing gel electrophoresis. And they learn how to run denaturing gel because they have to purify the strands.
Denaturing gel, okay.
Yeah, so there are two kinds of gels you run. Denaturing gel, it's basically, it's only a function of the molecular weight, and in the other, it's a function of the surface area and whatever.
Okay.
You know, and the mass, and it's complicated. The second experiment, which we don't have to do very much anymore, involves learning how to work with radioactivity, how to ligate a three-arm junction that has sticky ends on it, and then run it on a gel. And that three-arm junction, with the when you ligate it together, you get both linear pieces and cyclic pieces. And then the idea was to run it on the gel, and the counts are all in the longs in the cyclic pieces that are either longer or in the long pieces that are either cyclic or linear, and you can tell the difference.
Okay.
You do it at different gel concentrations, so you understand the importance of using different concentrations of gels and so forth. Then the third experiment is to take 10 strands of DNA, and you cook them up together, and you cool them down, and you make a little two-dimensional crystal of DNA that has a stripe on it, because there's a little domain of DNA coming out of that two-dimensional crystal. And then you look at that on the atomic force microscope. So mm-hmm. I learned how to use the atomic force microscope, and I learned how to cook these things. It was a very fast experiment. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is they set up some crystals just so they learn what's involved in setting up crystals.
And this is all within a month?
Like I said, that second experiment with radioactivity, mm-hmm. usually we're not doing that anymore because we hardly ever use radioactivity.
Okay.
Once in a while we do, but it used to be that everybody in the lab every 2 weeks got their own shipment of P-32. Till we started using the AFM maybe 12 or 13 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and then we just stopped. We still do it. I mean, there are times when we need it, but there are times when we don't need it, and, you know, I don't need any more counts in the lab than absolutely necessary.
Okay. Yeah. So the training exercises that you just set out, is that sort of a pretty standard routine that most faculty, you know, do? Or is
no, I mean, this is... These are things that I want somebody in my laboratory to know how to do.
I don't mean the specific ones. I mean just the you know, you come into my lab.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Because, you know, people come into this lab, mm-hmm. To a good approximation, they've never done anything like this before.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody works with DNA mm-hmm. the way we work with DNA, except for the other 60 labs who don't seem to be sending me graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to go reasonably soon.
Why don't we quit in 5? Is that good?
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's no urgency here. I mean, I just have to go to the cleaner and pick something up.
Okay.
And then go to a meeting at 5. So it's all within 5 minutes.
We'll be done by then. Okay.
So, you know, there's a book, the original edition of which was called Molecular Cloning.
Hmm.
And it was what was known as the Bible
mm-hmm.
in all the molecular biology labs in the 80s. And there was another edition of it came out in the 90s and so forth. And it was how, you know, biologists would clone DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I had to teach people was learn the protocols there and then ignore them. Because we're not doing biology here where it's good enough to get one molecule into a cell and you've cloned it up and then, you know, you can select for it and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We're chemists.
Mm-hmm.
We need 100% yields or, you know, high yields.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to purify away the crap from the failures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a totally other way of thinking about stuff. And you just, you know, that's just the way you have to operate
mm-hmm.
here. So most people, most of my colleagues, the organic chemists,
mm-hmm.
the physical chemists, whatever, people come into their labs, you know, they sort of know how to do some of it because they had an undergraduate degree in chemistry,
mm-hmm.
right? Nobody has an undergraduate degree in sort of DNA, nanotech, or new, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, when I was undergraduate taking chemistry courses, I mean, if somebody had told me to reflux a solution, you know, as an incoming graduate student, I probably would have, you know, had some idea, and I'd probably asked the senior graduate student, and I got some help.
Mm-hmm.
But there wouldn't have been an exercise designed to teach me how to reflux a solution or teach me how to do this, that, or the other.
Okay.
In one of the other labs. I mean, rotations in other labs, they actually have, you know, they're given a little rotation project.
Uh-huh.
You know, here's a little thing we need to know, see if you can just do this.
Yeah.
Or you even need to know, or we need you to make, and maybe it's a starting material for something else.
Yeah.
See if you can run an esterification.
Okay. Ned, I think what got me thinking about this was in looking at your webpage, was looking at the protocols.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think of my own graduate students, and it's a very different...
What are your students?
History. They're history students.
So they don't have protocols of the
same
sort.
No, but they have something similar in that they have to learn to work an archive, and they have to learn to work it efficiently.
Yeah.
So I will go with them, and we'll pull a box off, and, you know, how do you...
How do you look at it? Yeah.
I mean, this isn't like, you know, some like theoretical, historical, whatever. It's just, you have a bunch of papers, you've got 2 hours, how do you go through and get some information efficiently?
Okay, so you guys just come in here.
But I think maybe it's because my original training was a scientist, my way of approaching that is really different from how my colleagues do it, which is more like, I think there's an archive over there, go see what's there and come back and tell me about it.
Yeah.
My approach is much more different.
That's sort of the difference for me as the difference between being at a middle-level school and an elite school.
Huh.
All right? Because when I went to Pitt, I mean, in a sense, I lost a certain amount of big picture there.
Yeah.
But boy, did I learn crystallography.
Okay.
All right. I mean, when I went to Columbia, there was a sixth year graduate student there, who didn't know a quarter of what I knew, in the laboratory there. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to MIT, there was another sixth year student, who didn't know a quarter of what I had known, when I got out of Pitt.
Yeah.
And the reason is that in the elite institutions, science is often taught a la, you know, there's the lab, spend 4 or 5 years there, there's the typewriter, word processor, whatever, spend 3 or 4 months there, and come back with a thesis. See ya. You know, whereas at Pitt and at other middle-level institutions, and what I've continued doing here because fundamentally this is that kind of place, it's, we got to teach you how to do this, we're going to teach you how to do that, we're going to teach you how to do this, we're going to teach you how to do that. Now, we can't teach you how to write a grant, we can't teach you to understand what's important, because that's something that's got to come from here. It's not going to come from a training exercise.
When you say come from here, you mean?
From the gut.
Okay. Okay.
You know, you know, you've got to either have a sense of what's good stuff to do, or you don't.
So, how do you help your students pick a good problem?
I don't pick a problem. They don't pick any problems. I pick the problems.
Okay. Let me rephrase that then. Of the problems that you mean, do you just, you assign a particular problem to them, or do you say, here are the range of ones, pick one that looks interesting?
Well, if there's more than one student, I may say, we're planning to do this project, or we're planning to do that project, or planning to do that project.
Okay.
You know, pick one.
Okay.
That way, but, I mean, we're just completely on top of it.
And you have some sense of their relative talents, so...
No, not at the beginning.
Okay.
Okay, ultimately what I do, the best training is, the ideal training, which sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't, is I give a student an easy project that in a year, they'll work their way through the project all the way from conception to execution to publication. And then I give them a real problem where they learn the other thing that they have to learn, which is how to live with failure. That's the most important thing for them to learn, is how to live with failure and whether they can. Because in the end, you know, great scientists fail 90% of the time. Good scientists fail 95% of the time. Right? And the rest are 100% losers.
I actually thought you were going to go a different direction, which was to say great scientists fail 95% of the time because they're trying things that are like way out on the edge of doability.
Well,
and if you're a so-so scientist, you never really fail because you're never really pushing it.
Well, there may be that too.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I wish we failed only 90% of the time.
Okay.
But at any rate, you know, and the one thing I didn't mention about the technical part is in the beginning, that's 90% me or me and Ruji, and in the end, it's 100% the student. That means we've taught them how to do research. We haven't taught them, you know, how to plan a research program. Hopefully they'll learn that on their postdoc, if they're going to do that, or maybe it doesn't matter because they're going to an industrial job.
Yeah.
I only have 3 PIs, at least in America, as part of my products right now. I have a ton of kids out there as postdocs who may, some of whom will become PIs.
Okay. Before we wrap up for the day, you said something a little bit ago about having a lot of Chinese students, and I just wanted to come back to that before we finish up.
I mean, it's very simple. This is a mediocre university, and there is a dearth of American students going into science.
Yeah.
There are enough American students going into science such that the very top ones, you know, will fill up MIT and Caltech and Stanford and whoever else is out there. They won't fill up, but... Oops. Hello? There's almost nothing more pernicious than a telephone. I hate telephones.
I'm surprised. Yeah, I mean, I rarely get telemarketers calling me at my office.
Yeah,
that would drive me nuts.
Yeah.
Of course, University of California, we took away that. We just don't have office phones anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Who misses them?
Well,
I don't.
Yeah.
Anyway. I wouldn't. I mean, this one's rarely there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so often was the time, I mean, I was involved with graduate student recruitment for many years here. And, you know, you'd see somebody, you know, who was even of middle to sort of acceptable talent, you know, and they would be going to the sort of Pens of the world. And, you know, the ones, the domestic students we could attract. We don't have a good tie line to Europe. The Europeans we get are okay. Even the Latin Americans we get are okay. The Peruvians, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I had an Argentinian student one time. But the Americans suck. I mean, and, you know, to a pretty good first approximation. Once in a while you get a good one.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had one or two good Americans, but statistically they're not much good. And it's a choice that, you know, when you're sitting there on the admissions committee, are you going to take dumb Americans or smart Chinese?
This just goes off in a totally, you know, whatever, political direction, but why are the American students so bad?
Because there are very few highly talented people who want to go. I mean, I'll tell you a story about when I was in charge of admissions and graduate program and all that. This is an older story. It's like maybe 95. One of these Chinese students comes up to me and he says, how come we're all Chinese? And I say, well, you know, American students, the good American students, they go to law school, business school, medical school. And he said, I understand. Law school, business school, medical school, you have to pay tuition. We don't have any money. This is back when the Chinese had no money. So we have to go to graduate school. So our children can go to law school, business school, medical school. And damn if that ain't what's going on now. I mean, you know, 'cause I have some students who are, you know, from 20 years before.
Are their kids...
Their kids are, you know, going to things like that, yeah.
That's funny. I mean, the standard story that, you know, I always hear is that, you know, American students just... I mean, yeah, partly they want a professional degree because they, you know, will make more money. Part of it is just lack of aptitude and patience for...
Well, I mean, you know, and partly, you know, there's a generation sort of in between mine and the current generation that saw what happened to my generation. You know, you climbed, you climbed over the rainbow, and at the end of it was a pot of shit, right?
Okay.
Where the jobs weren't there. I mean, this shitty job that I complained about at Albany, there were 100 of us competing for academic jobs that year.
Yeah.
And I nominally got the best one. There were about six total. You know, some of which were like, you know, not really tenure track or whatever.
So there's a sense of why should I put myself through all
why
this?
Should I put, yeah, I mean, you know, when you're my age, what's 4 years, 5 years, who cares, you know? But when you're 21, 22, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, or better yet, when you're 18, you know, or 16 or 17, you mean to spend 6 years as a graduate student? Which was standard at MIT in biology.
With no guarantee of...
Well, actually, if you're coming through MIT, actually, you probably would. It was almost a guarantee. If you came through Pitt, I guarantee it wasn't. So, it was, you know, there was, that generation didn't go into science. And, you know, their kids don't even, you know, consider it an option. You know, the ones who are coming around now. I mean, there are a few more kids, you know, I explained when we recruited a bunch of physicists a few years ago, and many of them talked to me on the way here, and they said, well, what do you do about training grants? I said, listen, there are two ways you can support graduate students. Either you can get training grants if you have talented Americans. In fact, I told this to a guy who came here from Santa Barbara. And... or you can get enough research grants that you don't have to worry about where they're from, right? And we've chosen the latter path because they're good students. We can't get good American students.
Okay. Hey, let's pause there for now, and we can
pick up tomorrow at about 11.
Yeah, I'm going to stop this here.
Okay.
That's the stop button, not the erase button.